On this episode of Pottages.
Maybe this is all my fault. What have I done?
You can blast all the bad guys with it.
Mako. Awesome.
Remember, the fate of the world lies in your hands!
But I used my power against the neighborhood kid, and I hurt him.
What's happening, guys?
That's so typical. Can't you ever just walk in and say hello?
I need your password.
You can use mine to get on the internet.
I did it.
Welcome to Pottages, episode 311. When is a schmuck just a schmuck?
D Reaper, part 1.
Home, The Fault in Our Fates, and D Reaper Horror.
Recorded July 9th, 2016.
Pottages is your critically nostalgic analytical tour through the Digimon anime. I'm Jeff Ruberg, and I'm joined by my fellow Diginomes, Ashley McDonald.
The fate of the world is in your hands.
Okay. And Asher Soffman.
The power is yours.
The way he said all. So funny. Oh, that's great.
And Andrew Soffman is off working on a Saturday because that's a thing people do, apparently.
It's a thing people do, yeah. A thing Jews are supposed to do.
Ooh. Oh. On that note, this week we're looking at the first half of the D Reaper arc with episodes 42 through 46. In episode 42, Reunion, aka Home is Where the Heart Shirt Is, Takato takes a train ride home and learns about post-9/11 racial profiling. Rika marks her Sundaria evolution with a new heart container. Henry gets a lecture about morally ambiguous clouds. And Jerry teaches her family about the terror of puberty. The D-Reaper raises the stakes by introducing the threat of CGI animation.
In episode 43, Beelzemon's Big Day, aka Blasmo Beautiful, the kids sleep at school and eat a healthy diet of bread. Infodump hippie professor reappears because infodumps transcend physical digital boundaries. Impmon reunites with his tamers and a toddler gives a giant rifle to a murderous demon lord.
In episode 44, The Messenger, aka Goth Ex Machina, the kids get one last chance to mooch off their parents before leaving them defenseless and alone in an evacuated city. It's a metaphor for growing up. A new mysterious tamer shows up, and on a completely unrelated note, Dolphin really wants the camera to see him fumble with a family portrait.
In episode 45, The D-Reaper's Disguise, aka Sleeper Reaper Creeper, the kids practice their soliloquy game as the side tamers complain about not being invited to the lava lamp party. Jerry gets an angel growth spurt, and an unwanted guest reappears.
In episode 46, When is a Mon Just a Mon, aka When is a Schmuck Just a Schmuck, Innocent Mon and Guilty Mon search for Jerry, while Giant Bunny Mon and Sixth Ranger Nobody Wanted Mon defeat the D-Reaper's Green Goblin. Takato is saved from the horrors of puberty by a kiss-spewing pocket angel. Episodes, Digimon Tamers, Real World, D-Reaper, Buzzword, Growth, Hacking, Social Engineering, stuff. Okay, yes. So,
Jeff, are you okay?
Do you need help?
Yeah, this arc was, to me, felt like a return of very serialized stuff. I don't know how you guys felt.
Really?
You didn't think it was... I feel like several of the episodes were... Oh, not that much happened, but I guess they move things... They move several different pieces along a little bit.
I felt like a lot happened in these episodes.
No. It almost reminded me a lot of Game of Thrones in that in any one episode, it felt like each like chess piece didn't really move that much because like all of them are moving a little bit at a time. And then when you like step back and look at the... You know, a chunk of them, you're like, okay, they all moved a lot. But like in each episode, you're like, no one really moved that much in this episode. There were like a couple episodes that stood out as like, okay, something major happened in this episode, but it was really just the Beelzemon episode to me. I don't know.
I mean, I would agree with that. I don't know.
Yeah.
It wasn't so much like, it wasn't like rote.
Yeah, it wasn't monster of the day.
Well, sure. And like,
Tamers digivolved, so now this one has to.
Right. Like, Tamers has never followed that formula.
Well, it kind of did at the beginning.
Yeah, you're right. Tamers, especially with the Devas, is the one place where it's like, this is definitely Monster of the Week. So, I don't know. Okay, I will cede that point. That's not the right word. Anyway, but yeah, so I felt like looking back on the arc, I'm like, oh, I really like this arc. But in no moment of watching it was I like, yes, this arc is so amazing.
Yeah, I would agree with that. There was nothing I was like, yeah, like lots of stuff is happening. I'm not too excited by this. I don't know. It introduces new characters that I'm like, ah.
Well, one new character.
Two, if you include the Digimon.
Digimon aren't characters, Ashley.
Wow.
They're just tools.
That's mean.
I mean, a Digimon that dies 2 minutes after you meet him barely counts as a character, oh. I feel.
Wow.
It's like...
Wow. Generally related to Alice and Doberman, I felt like it kind of reinforced the fact that girls suffer a lot more in Digimon. Because, like, there's no dude who has just totally lost their Digimon. Like, Ryo, okay, I guess his Digimon is corrupt. But, like, everything that we see of his Digimon is, like, it turned into some cute little rookie thing now. It's now they can biomerge. Like, what? There's no conflict there, really.
Yeah. I'll have more to say about that when we have a little thing in Straight Bits to talk about Alice if we don't get to it otherwise. Because, yeah, I do agree that is plays into girls and women suffering more. Like, it's like she's introduced and then, like, you know, a couple minutes later, it's about her suffering and having, you know, like, dealing with loss. And
also, the idea of sacrifice for the greater good is often, like, given to, that role is given to girls. When it's given to boys, it comes through in a different way. Like, the boys get something out of their suffering, while the girls don't seem to so much.
They get more suffering.
Yeah, basically.
I guess this is one instance. I've always, like, kind of been like, I'm not entirely sold when we've talked about, like, the differences in genders of suffering and that kind of stuff. But, like, this is something where, like, I could not envision a dude character being introduced and then immediately being reduced to, like, a now you've suffered. Like, now, you know, be sad about your Digimon that you lost.
Right?
Like that.
See?
Yeah.
So. Right? A dude would get to join the group.
And he did.
Yeah.
No, we're not going to talk about him.
Yeah, we're not talking about him. Okay. We're not talking about Schmuck right now.
Let's talk about our favorites instead. So favorite character is obviously, let's all say it. So in the count of three, like, I'll count down when I say, okay, I'm not going to say zero. I'm going to start at three. I'm not going to say zero. But when I would say zero is when we all say the name. Okay. So favorite character, we're all going to say it. We're all going to say in synchronized in harmony. Okay. 3, 2, 1. Beelzebub, Blast Mode, Beautiful Baby.
What?
I said Beelzebub, Blast Mode, Beautiful Baby.
Oh.
No, not in the least.
Rika's mom, followed closely by Guillemon.
I didn't hear what you said.
I said Angel Jerry.
Angel Jerry. Is that your actual answer?
I don't have an actual answer. I kind of liked everybody.
That's the rabbit answer.
That's how I felt, but there was...
But I liked that Ryo got pushed around. So Ryo is good for that. But I kind of liked everybody.
And I picked Rika's mom because when she did the shirt thing with Rika, I was like, oh my god, she is my mom. How is this possible?
Wow. Huh, I didn't make that connection, but now I can see it.
Yeah.
I didn't choose Rika's mom as a favorite character, but I did put that down. I have a list of, like, favorite scenes or scenes that really stood out, and that that scene really stood out. It was my second highest one because it's like Rika's dreading the gift because she's like, oh, my mom's gonna get me some stupid clothing I'm not gonna like, and then she opened it and it's like, oh, it's actually something that is made for me, and then the extra turning the knife in the gut, but like the most, like, the positive version of that.
I don't know if there is one. The icing on the cake.
Yes, the icing, the turn of the icing in your gut.
Ew. That sounds like a medical problem.
Anyway, that thing is her, like, revealing that she's wearing the matching version, and...
That was nice. That was a nice touch.
Yeah. It just shows how far she's come in terms of accepting her, in terms of being on the same page with her, as showing that she...
Yeah.
I mean, it was like what I said about when we got the, like, glimpse of Takato's parents making Guillemon bread while they were in the digital world. Like, they are, you know, dealing with their kids not being present by, like, trying to connect with them and growing closer to them in these ways, and it's really sweet. I also just really like the dynamic of... is after Rika leaves and Rika's mom is, like, talking to Seiko. So Rumiko is talking to Seiko and is like, what do I do now? And it's like, you see her as a parent ask her own parent for help in this.
Yeah, I really liked that too.
Yeah. I think I have like a thing for like showing like a line of generations, and I don't know, the things that come to mind immediately are things that I watched recently. Gilmore Girls has like a lot of daughter, mother, and grandmother dynamic, and Orphan Black has actually four generations of that. There's daughter, mother, foster mother, foster mother's mother, and I think they're all really that especially is like so much more. It's like this relationship. Well, like, as all three of those, Tamers, Gilmore Girls, and Orphan Black, they're not like happy. Everyone gets along all the time. There's like things that are fraught in the different dynamics and make it really sweet when they come together. And anyway,
I mean, yes. It felt really Gilmore Girls, like actually, when Rika's mom was like, you know, people told me when I got pregnant or whatever that like I was crazy for having you or whatever she actually says.
It was about marriage, not about young
whatever
pregnancy.
I don't remember, guys. I watched these episodes a week ago.
you just replaced it. You replaced your Gilmore Girls memories into that.
Probably. So tired. Yeah. And I watched these episodes a week ago. Leave me alone.
Yeah, I mean, the age dynamics are very similar to Gilmore Girls.
Right? And like, that's why, and yeah, so she like gets married, but then clearly her dad isn't there, so it's like, okay.
Yeah.
Didn't he die?
I don't know.
In which Tamers?
In Digimon? Do they ever say?
No, they don't really specify, and I haven't looked through this part of Kanaka's notes in a while, but what I recall reading a while ago was that he specifically was like, I have not thought through what happened to him. Oh. Or like, I don't specifically have anything in mind that like he left them or died or anything. It's just like, he's just not a part of their life. And the movie, I don't know exactly. I think the second movie, the Runaway Lokomon one, I can't remember exactly, but it goes into it in some level. And that was not written by Kanaka. Yeah, fans sometimes don't like that aspect of it. Anyway, yeah, other scenes I really liked. Just Beelzebub Redemption in general is awesome. We'll get to it later. Inma not being able to read and having to carry around the note from the kids is so great. And Beelzebub hanging out with Calamon and like working together was really great. Really, really good. I'll get to that later too. The kids baking was a sweet moment. And the parents serving them lunch was those two moments were really great. Yeah.
I actually thought that was going to be a trap. I was like, this isn't real. This isn't real.
It's a trap.
Who are these parents? What are they doing? Why didn't they sign the note?
I mean, I found it really that, like, it's a trap thing kind of silly because it's like you're facing not a human enemy. You're not.
Right. No, that idea was dumb. But I was like, what is this?
It's a trap. We're locking you in the house.
Yeah, and
you're never
like,
leaving.
It could have been a thing like when Devimon did the thing with the mansion. Like, because later on the D-Reaper was like, your fears will undo you. Also, I know all this junk.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, but yeah. That was just a really weird moment. It felt out of place, but it was nice, but it was weird.
Yeah, I guess I think it works because you kind of expect the parents to be like, we invited you here, and the offer is eat with us, we'll help you, but you cannot leave. And to see them, like, help them and then be like, no, it's okay, we know you need to go. Like, we're supporting you, we're also conceding, like, it's like the surprise, like, they are much more accepting than we kind of expected or thought was reasonable. And
yeah, I don't think this is reasonable, for one thing. They are 10 or 12, depending.
Well, also, I had forgotten this was a thing until I looked at the plot summary of the next couple episodes. At these episodes, they don't know that they've merged the Digimon. They don't know that they're actually the ones out there fighting. They think they're just, like, accompanying them. My topic is about the idea of home in general, but I'll start off with what I thought was a very prominent theme this arc, and I really enjoyed it, which is the idea that they come home and find things off. Everything's a little bit different. Everything's a little bit unsettlingly the same and nostalgic, but very different. So some quick examples of that, and I'm going to dive into them more depth. But so like Shinjuku's empty, the families are relocated, Hypnos is relocated, they're sleeping in school, they're making food by themselves, like a lot of things that are just off. So I'm going to dive into them in more depth. And it's also explicitly called out in the beginning of this arc. So when it's when Takato and Gilmon are on the train, and Takato's like, it's weird to be back. And Gilmon's like, it's always been weird for me. Yeah, it's kind of like, on some level, acknowledged by the show. But yeah, So
I mean, I thought it was weird that Gilman thought it was weird because he was born there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that doesn't make sense.
Cute, yeah. But I was like, what?
Yeah, I don't think that was a very internally consistently written line that, yeah.
I mean, maybe it was weird for him because he was excluded from everything, which, but they could've, mm-hmm. I don't know. It was still odd.
Yes, definitely. Okay, so Shinjuku is evacuated and empty, and that causes the families to stay in different places. This is something that I don't think I was really aware of at the time, the geography. And I think the way the families are displaced is a fairly direct metaphor for how much the characters have changed. Specifically that Jerry's family is the one family that's relocated to very far away, to like a 3-hour train ride away to Matsumoto. Mm-hmm. And she's obviously the one whose character is like completely changed or held hostage or whatever, put into stasis by the D-Reaper and stuff. And also Takato, he never actually gets to his family moved to, I forget where, to like their aunt's house. And they tell him in the last episode we watched, the last arc, to meet up mm-hmm. back there. And then the beginning of this arc, he decides to, he like, starts to go down that path to meet up with his parents and then doesn't. So like he never actually gets home. And I feel like that is kind of indicative of his character, is a little bit wandery, a little bit aimlessly finding direction, a little bit, but not quite as strong as like Jerry's definitely the one who is removed from everyone else and is physically removed too. And also just like once they get into Shinjuku, once the three kids are kind of spending time in Shinjuku, it's like the town is a hollow shell with former self. Mm-hmm. And the one place they went to all the time before, the park, I don't think they were there because the arc emerged in the fountain area, but they haven't been back there aside from that. And mm-hmm. I guess that's directly because the D-Reaper hasn't infected those areas, but like, it just reminded me that like these places that were a staple of where they've been, everything's mm-hmm. different now and they're not there anymore. And it's a totally different landscape now. I also thought, so we can see with all the family lives, how they're like all a little bit different. I mean, like you see them in their different settings and their different contexts and how you can like see what you remember what they used to be like and how they're now. And you're like, okay, this is different. This is a little bit weird. And you're like, Rika's family being in an apartment is like, that doesn't feel right. They should have like a traditional Japanese home. But anyway, the one family life that stands out from that is Jerry's, because we never really seen, we'd seen like a couple very brief glimpses into her home situation before, but like nothing as much as even what we get in this arc is like really small. It's a couple minutes, but like it's still a lot more than we've gotten before. So it's like, it's really hard to gauge whether stuff with her family, like with her stepmother, is off, or whether that's just like how their family normally is. You know, like, is it normal for Jerry to like wrestle her brother to the floor and the stepmother to be like, or is that like a super weird thing now that things are different? I don't know. Like, we don't really know.
I think it made it pretty clear.
That seemed like a super
weird
thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
It made it clear enough that it was weird.
Okay. I did not phrase that pretty well. I don't think that exact situation is a normal thing. I guess what I found hard to gauge was like the stepmother's reaction to everything. Cause we don't know, like, is she mm-hmm. normally very cold? Is she normally very kind? And like, we don't, and like, yeah, we've seen her like be very in the last arc at the very end. We saw her like happy that she was home. But again, like all the other family members we've seen before they disappeared for a while and after they disappeared for a while. And they, like after they disappeared, they like warmed up and like were like so happy they're back. But we don't know, like, was she more cold before they left or like, I don't know.
I mean, Jerry herself has said that her stepmother wanted to be friends with her.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I got the impression that it was like she sort of wanted maybe to be more actively like, hey, Jerry, are you okay? But it was also trying to be like, well, Jerry didn't want to be friends with me, so I'm trying to give her space or whatever.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And not be overly cold.
Sure. So all this, I'm just saying that, yeah, we can make reasonable approximations and guesses, but I think it kind of solidifies and strengthens the otherness of her, that even when we get a glimpse into her family, we're still not, it's still not in the same way as everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And the scene with the kids baking bread, it was kind of another example of just things being a little bit off, because it's like, this is normally a place where the parents bake, but now the kids are baking there. But more so than that, I thought it was just, it shows how the group has matured, they're self-sufficient now, and they're reliable, they can, like, fend for themselves. But then, like, tied into that, that was, I guess that was the second episode we watched, and then the third episode, directly after that, after they've been self-sufficient and, you know, they don't need their parents really much, that much anymore, they then get to be kids again and get to have their parents cook for them and make them meals. And, like, I thought that was sweet that it's, like, they've matured, but, like, they are still kids. And they do still have these important connections. They do still, it is important that they...
Yeah, and the food the grown-ups made was a lot better and more nutritional.
Yeah, it wasn't just bread. It wasn't just bread. I did find it kind of a little odd how it's like, Gilmon was like, oh my God, Gilmon bread. I'm like, you just had Gilmon bread the other day? Like, you made your own?
Yeah, but it looked kind of sucky.
I mean, it wasn't as good. I was very confused by that. I was like, how did you do this?
Yeah, that I was confused if they were... What I assumed happened was that the Takata's parents had gone to the bakery to make bread and then brought it to the house. Like, they both used the bakery. It wasn't just like they made bread at Rika's house.
They could have, though.
Could they?
Yeah, you just need the ingredients and an oven, really.
I guess so.
I mean, unless you feel the need to use a bread maker, but they didn't seem to use those in their bakery either.
No. Also, you need a Gilmon bread shaped bread maker.
Oh, yeah. Well, how did Gilmon do it then?
Who knows? Anyway, so Ruki, what about Ruki? Rika, and Rika having friends over was really sweet. And we were talking before the trapness of it. And that I think a dialogue about like being a trap thing was more, I forget exactly what I read about how it was in the Japanese version, but I think it's either not present discussion of it as a trap in Japanese, or it's less strong. And like what she's mainly, the Japanese version makes it more clear that she's worried because she's like, this is the first time I've had friends over, or I've never had friends over before. And like, yeah. And that was really cute. It was adorable.
Oh, is that why Rika was like embarrassed or whatever?
Yeah. And in the dub, they just made it about how like, it's a trap. It's definitely a trap, guys. I think it's a trap. And they're like, no, Rika, it's not a trap. And you can read into those things too. Like, it's not like, we can still apply that Japanese interpretation onto what she says in English, but like, I like how they make that clear. Other things, yeah. So, and I think it's just an example of like these things that are off or different. Some of them are like off and unsettling. Some of them are just like the characters have moved a lot, have changed a lot since they left the digital world. Like the parents are much more happy the kids are back and more welcoming and accepting of them. And I mean, Rika having friends over the first time is not really a sign of how she's changed since the digital world, but is a sign of how she's changed since the beginning of the series. And it's a really neat milestone for her.
Mm-hmm.
Did you guys notice anything else that felt off or different about the world since they came back?
I mean, you insist that it is a little bit off, and I'm like, no, it's like part of it is destroyed. It's very off. It's taken to an extreme.
That's true. Yeah. When I say a little bit off, it's like in the larger picture, it's like everything's completely different, but then like they keep doing stuff. And while they're doing stuff, I keep getting signals of like, wait, everything's normal again. Wait, no, it's not. There's like, things aren't right. And it's like, it's this, that level of like, they're going about their everyday routine. They're going about their like new routine in this completely changed city. And then there are little reminders everything's off. But I guess, yeah, you're right. That like the things that make them change their routine, what they're doing these episodes, is very big and yeah, exaggerated. And
I mean, they're like sleeping in a school. I don't know, man.
Yeah, like, I guess it's not quite so little.
Like, it makes sense when you're like, okay, Takato's on a train, that feels more but normal, I guess. But when they're like in the actual city, I'm like, there's nothing normal about this.
So the next thing I wanted to compare it to is how Adventure had a very similar moment to this, which is when Tai comes home and just goes to his house and everything is different, and he hesitates to open the door because he's like, I don't know, like if everything's going to be the same. Like, I forget exactly what his reasoning is for not wanting to open the door, but I wanted to compare those. And I think that Adventure worked better in a lot of ways because, first of all, they had a very abrupt artistic style change. And I want to say like they were lucky, but also like it was just very effectively planned because it was like, they were able to have Tai jump back to Tai jump to the real world, have a very abrupt style change, and then have him go back to the real world, then go back to the digital world, so that when they eventually all came back to the real world, they didn't have to keep up that style change. You know, like, it would have been really jarring if there was only one leap, if like all the kids came back, the first episode in the real world, style is completely different, and they just drop that the next episode while they're still in the real world or whatever. But like, because he jumps back and forth, you like, I don't think people are immediately like, when all the kids come back to the real world, they're not like, wait, but the real world looked different last time. It's yeah. So having that one episode, that one off thing, allowed them to do that abrupt style change in an interesting way. And it also, that style change like was the same style as the Adventure OVA, like both were Hosoda. And so it was when Tai comes back to his apartment, which is the setting of the OVA, the same setting, the same style. It, like, it's very different from the rest of Adventure. It ties back to that early thing, and, like, you know, both for him and the audience, if the audience saw the OVA when it aired the day before the series started in Japan or whatever, gives you nostalgia for, like, oh, we're back, but things aren't the same anymore, and things are weird, and it's not the same tone as the OVA, and, yeah, so. And I guess it's just, Adventure's that difference of like things being different feels more obvious to me. Like, and I think because it's more obvious, it's more accessible to more viewers to be like, because I feel, well, actually no, because I guess I was gonna say that the things in Tamers are more subtle, but yeah, Ashley, as you pointed out, they are pretty huge. It's like they come back and the city is completely different.
I feel like these things are not comparable, to be honest. Like, the way that it's used in adventure is much more the, like, subtle playing to your, like, you want to go home, like, you've been on this adventure the whole time, you want to go home, you want it to be, you want it to feel the same as it did before, but it just doesn't, and not because things at home changed, but just because, like, you changed as a person, or, like, things at home have changed, but, like, if you had been there at the time, you would have been like, whatever, that's a gradual thing that you, like, easily accept. Whereas in Tamers, it's like they go knowing, like, oh my god. Well, I guess they don't know that D Reaper is gonna follow them, but like when they do find that out, they're like, oh my god, we gotta go defeat the D Reaper. Like, and it's different in Tamers because like we've spent all that time with them in the real world. Like, we've spent more time with them in the real world than in the digital world.
Right, but like. Yeah, I think that's an interesting difference because in adventure, it's like, we don't know what Ty's normal life was really like before he goes home. So like, we don't have that direct comparison. Whereas, so all we get is the Ty like talks about how things are different for him, right? And like, he feels very listless and is like, you really directly, I think it's like, has to be part of the narrative that he feels like he wanted things to return home and like things aren't, he can't really return home anymore. But whereas in Tamers, since we've gotten so many episodes of them in the real world, when they come back, they don't need to make that part of the narrative. They don't need to make it about the kids being like, I wanted to come back, but now things are so different. Like, we get that, right? Because it's, we have to make the comparison ourselves. I don't know.
I just don't feel like, I don't think the kids are even thinking about that, though. I think they're just like, there is an immediate threat. It doesn't matter everything is different.
It's like, yeah, and all the things that make it different are things that are caused by the immediate threat.
Yeah.
So it's not like, yeah, I guess because, yeah, adventure, it does become, it was more about like how, you know, because Ty has changed, he can't ever, the place he thought of his home is never going to be quite the same anymore. But here it's literally like everything's broken because of the D-Reaper. Once we fix the D-Reaper, everything will be back to normal, kind of, is the implication.
Except all those buildings are still going
to
be chewed up.
I don't know what's going to happen to those. I don't know if they ever talk about that or clear that, or explain that. But
And I mean, I assume that after all of this, they would then have similar feelings to Ty, where it's like, right, well, now nothing is the same.
That's good. Those are all good points.
Even though it's like sort of what it was before, but we've been to the digital world and like fought a thing that was trying to destroy us.
It does kind of seem like I'm trying to fit Tamers into the adventure hole in this regard. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's not working. I don't agree.
I think there are shades, there are aspects of it, but it is drastically different.
Pat, I'm sorry.
What?
I said Pat. I'm sorry. I pat you on the head.
Okay, so I do want to talk more about the concept of home. Not so much in the homecoming concept, because I had a lot more to talk about that, but then Ashley tore it apart. So thanks, Ashley. But no.
That's what we're here for.
I'll just call it like it is, man.
So what I was thinking about is, so I had lots of thoughts about how we form the concept of home, and inherent in home is the sense that it's like a place that you have been to enough times that you consider it to be a stable thing that doesn't change. But inherent in that is that we as people change. So there's always going to be that dichotomy of like, you come back and things are different now, not because a thing is actually different, but because it is a stable, non-moving idea and you have moved, it is different. Whether that's like going on vacation, going to college, going, I don't know, like I had a whole list somewhere. But anyway, that stuff I think is kind of relevant because that's the kind of homecoming that adventure portrays. And this homecoming is not quite that. And yeah, maybe trying to force it into that a little bit too much. But anyway, but the other kind of home thing I wanted to talk about and think about was like how we form the concept of home and how it isn't always just a place. And here's my postulation that the Tamers are a kind of home. The group, the main three and the others, whatever, they're included a little bit. They get guest access cards into the house. But that they're kind of, especially like they come back together and it's like the other homecoming is the kids, like they split up in the Canis Arc and then they come back together and it's like, yes, the group is back together. That is the home. What do you guys think about? Do you think that's BS?
No, I agree with that.
Okay. Ashley?
No, I think that's BS.
No. I think it's actually more that the when they're all split up, it's like, what are we doing? Where are we going? When are they going to get back together again? Like, this is what we are here for.
Yeah. I mean, I just can't agree with it being a homecoming for them, because they clearly all, like, want to be with their parents, yeah, feel very upset each time they have to be split from them.
Although, when they did come back together at the waterway, and the way they all kind of jokingly, like, oh, you were going to go off alone, huh? That felt very belongy to me.
Sure.
Yeah, I can see that it's, to some degree, it is hard to buy the universe characters think of it as their home when they have a home that they feel much more guilty about leaving. But yeah, especially to the viewer, they are our home in regards to Digimon. Like, that is the thing that we returned, the thing that we want out of the show. So anyway, Impmon, he returns to his literal home, to Ayamaka's. Like, it's a different house. He goes to the original house, gets the note, goes to their other house. But really, the Tamers are his home, quote unquote. And it's poignant how they treat him exactly how he hoped they would treat him. Like, especially like that mirage he gets from Katuramon and Katsuramon, whatever the name is. And they're like his mirage is that they'll be, well, no, the mirage is that they won't accept him, but he, like, is hoping that they will be so happy to see him. And that's, like, what happens. Like, he comes back and they're so happy to see him, and they, like, dote on him and all this stuff. And that was sweet, and kind of reveals how it was really just his own fear holding him back, which is very relatable. But anyway, that's in some sense a homecoming. But what I think is the more emotional homecoming is his joining the team, finally. And that it's, like, the team is a home that he rejected in the first arc, in the real world stuff. He rejected, but not so secretly, really wanted in, and was like, this friend group, I hate you, but actually I do kind of like you, but I hate you guys. And then he accepted having to burn down this home to get what he wanted in the digital world. And to see him come back to that is just... It's like, it finally feels like he has a place where he really belongs. And I guess that is a sense where I think of the Tamers as a home, because it can give a place of belonging to someone like Impmon, Beelzemon.
That makes me think about Lopmon and the fact that she is displaced from her home. And it feels that way looking at her, actually.
Yeah, like, Lopmon never seems quite that happy.
Yeah, she's like, I like you, Susie, but... Yeah.
No, she mostly, I have never gotten the sense after their initial meeting where she was Aunt Tilamon. Like, I feel like she kind of doesn't like hanging out with Susie when she is Lopmon, but is cool with it when she's in Tilamon.
I think she just doesn't fit in right with this world. And it's hard to say where that's coming from, since we only see her in, like, 30-second intervals. But it's odd. She really doesn't seem to belong there.
Yeah.
I'm sticking by what I said.
I can see that too. This is what it means to be Deva to a 5-year-old. Yeah.
Regret your decisions.
Regret!
I also wrote down, I was like, so I was on this route of Impmon being, like, having homecoming. I was like, you know, it's probably true of, like, all of the sixth ranger Digimon characters have a feeling where they come home to the group eventually. And then I was like, not really for, like, Kari or Gatomon. Gatomon, I guess, to some degree, because she's like, I was fated for this. Now I feel like she was not at home in Myotismon's army, and now she's like, no, this is where I belong. Well, okay, I guess the thing, like, I think all of them have a sense, like, once they've joined, they're like, this is where I belong. But none of them quite have a, like, returning sense like Impmon does. Because Impmon, like, mm-hmm. had lots of interactions with them beforehand, rejected them, was like, I'm too cool for your party, and then completely, like, throws them under the bus or the motorcycle, and then comes back. But yeah, so, like, Ken never had a wanting to be part of them. He threw them under the bus a lot and then joined them, but so it's not really quite returning for him, but it is, yeah, I don't know. Any thoughts along those lines?
I mean, Ken had a whole episode about home, so I don't know.
Hmm.
And, like, he really did want to join the group after he was rehabilitated.
Yeah.
I don't know if he wanted to join them, but he wanted them to accept him. And then, like, you know, he invited them over to his house. So I think there is a lot you could do with Ken and home and belonging and friendship. But we're not here to talk about Ken.
Yeah.
Ashley's very sad that we're not here to talk about Ken. Anymore.
I know, I am. I am very sad.
I guess currently where my head is at is I'm like, okay, if I accept that the Tamers are home to each other because I think that friends are just family that you choose, which kind of makes that bond stronger, and then is family more of just an obligation sort of thing? But I'm like, but they feel obligation to each other as friends that have to fight like a really strong enemy.
I don't think obligation and that home and that family stuff are, like, I don't think they are mutually opposed. Like, I think, you know, like, those kinds of strong, healthy bonds can form from obligation. You know, like, I don't think, like, you can have strong obligations. I mean, we have an obligation to this podcast, but we also enjoy doing it.
Well, do we?
No.
Oh!
Ash, what I mean is, like, I can guilt trip you and be like, Ash, we need to record. And you'll be like, and you can be like, ugh, I really don't want to do it, but I guess I have an obligation to Jeff to do
but
it.
But see, that's a grudging obligation. This is what I'm trying to, I guess that's the distinction I'm trying to make, is they feel like a friendly, happy obligation to each other, even though they're like, oh my God, we might die. Whereas they feel sort of like a grudging one towards their family, where they're like, oh, you keep trying to hold me back, but like, I love you. So like,
I think they're different kinds of obligations, because they also do really love their family and like, appreciate them, and it's different from having comrades to go into battle with. So it could be different types of homes, I guess. There's the home that's the traditional home with the family, and this is where we eat, this is where we sleep, this is where we feel safe. And then there's the home you make on the road with the people who are doing what you're doing, and
words.
You're the most like, awake one here. You gotta think of the words.
Safety. It's a different kind of safety there too. I guess if home is safety.
Well, okay. So there's a concept that really reminds me of, which I can't remember where I heard. I think it was a podcast. I'll link it in the show notes. It's a really, really interesting listen. It's about, I forget what it's called. So it's this, basically otaku or anime fans in Japan who make a habit of seeking out the locations from their favorite anime, which is like kind of like, you know, like we as tourists, like Ashley and I did when going to Tokyo for Digimon stuff, but like they do it more regular, like they're, you know, around locations, and like there are people who, you know, like the anime will feature some obscure city or some obscure town, and like there are people who like live nearby there, and they go, you know, a couple miles away to like scout out this town to find locations like that. And it's kind of like a whole lifestyle. But yeah, and in this discussion of like, of anime and locations and stuff, was this concept of like the reason why a lot of anime studios do this is because like it helps the viewers kind of like feel at home in these locations, having them be so realistic and modeled on real places. And the inherent in that is this importance of, what do they call it? A third place that, or no, like a third, I think they call it
a third object.
I think they called it a third place, but like it's very similar to what we're talking about at home. Like that, like you have your, the place where you sleep, the place where you go to work, and then like that it's important to have this other place that like, like the place where you sleep is like your home. I guess you can kind of say work, like your work, family, whatever, but like that then like that, what you were describing, like the home you meet on the road, whatever, that I think is what they're kind of talking about, this third place that like, and to some, a lot of people, that's what anime kind of is in a weird sense. Like you, it like on a regular basis, you return to this place and you see, like, you revisit them every week, you get to know these people and stuff, and the fictional people and all that stuff. But anyway, it's a really interesting podcast. If that sounded intriguing, you should listen to it. Ashley, what's the Fault in Our Fates?
Oh man, okay, so I will preface this by saying I started preparing for this topic before even watching these episodes and was like, I probably shouldn't do that. And then immediately, like the first thing that Rika says, she's watching a TV report about the D-Reaper, and she was like, if we, like, this wouldn't have happened if it hadn't followed us home or something. And I'm like, yes, fault right away. Let's go. Let's just go right there. I, unlike Jeffrey, am not going to list all of the instances in which this comes up, however, because that is useless.
Okay.
And just waste 10 minutes of time. I will start off with my thesis. Whether I correctly argue that thesis will be debatable. However, I believe that this is the line of my thought. It is basically, fault corrupts your destiny and or fate. Initially, this topic was going to be about how they're different, but then I couldn't. I think that the show mostly treats them the same. but we can argue about that later. And then, in fact, Fault destroys your fate slash destiny in a way that reinforces the need to fulfill said destiny slash fate. So, like, Fault is the thing that makes you unable to fulfill your destiny slash fate, but it is also the thing that reinforces the need for you to do the thing that you are fated to do. Thus, in the end, you are making your own destiny, and it is not predetermined in a strange way.
Well, say more. Yeah.
Please say more.
I don't think what you said really makes or doesn't make makes the case for it being predetermined or not. Like, what you're saying is that Fault is what people carry around that makes them feel obligated to do things, right? But it is also what makes them feel like they cannot achieve things, if I'm understanding correctly.
I don't respond to arguments that use the word things.
Why? I'm trying to take what...
I'm missing a step, I think, in that what makes Fault make people not do their thing? Do you accept questions with the word things in them?
Because they get... Okay, well, that's the basis of the argument, is like Fault is the thing that keeps you... That holds you back from doing anything, basically.
Is it fear of Fault or just guilt in the first place?
I mean, it's just like guilt. Like, I don't... Like, there are many moments where John Yu or like Yamaki will be like, if I just hadn't done this thing, then... this wouldn't have happened. And they just get like so mad about it. And then they're just like, they have to like talk to each other about how it's like, it's not your fault. Like, let's just keep going on. And like,
right.
Or if you blame other people, it's normally just a way for it to be like, you are not taking personal responsibility to move forward with whatever you're mad about that you didn't move forward with. Because you feel like something was in the way, but like you're not actively trying to get over it.
Okay.
And like Jerry is apparently living in a ball of sad, captured by the D Reaper.
Right.
Because she's just like, it's my fault that Guillaumon died, or Leomon died.
Guillaumon did not die. Oh no,
that's a whole new tragic show.
On the other hand, though, Impmon is entirely motivated by guilt at this point. So,
That's true, but he is forgiven.
Not yet, he isn't.
Oh, well, not by Jerry, but he's forgiven by his tamers.
Okay, sure.
I think that gave him the power to move forward. He's like, okay, I corrected this one thing, so now I'm confident that I can correct this other thing.
Okay, I see that.
Yeah. Anyway, I think the whole basis of Fault is sort of silly. Like, finding fault in things, again, often leads to this paralysis because, like, it's often that you there's no one moment of fault that you can just, like, be like, yeah, if this one thing hadn't have happened, then a whole other series of events wouldn't happen. And my metaphor was, like, a sports metaphor where if it's, like, in games where it's lower scoring, not, like, football and whatever, but, like... a hockey game where it's 2-1 or whatever.
Right.
You know, if you did something on the play that led to one of those two goals, like you're on the losing team and led to one of those two goals, you'll often feel like it was your fault that you lost the game. But that's right. So hard to determine because that just like, if that goal hadn't happened, then the whole series of events that followed it would be completely different because like right. The play would start from a different place and like all these things.
Right. I mean, another way of just like framing this is that finding fault for things is like attributing the cause for whatever outcome. And it's just when there's a negative outcome and you want to find the negative cause, like, and it's almost impossible to narrow any, like everything is a, you know, result of several different causes and a whole, like several different causes and a whole chain of all of them in every different direction. So like narrowing it down to like one thing, even if it's like a big thing, it's like without the thing removed, you also can't predict how things would have gone. So like it's never really necessarily accurate to pinpoint like this is the reason a thing happened. Like it's almost impossible given what we experience in reality to find causes accurately.
Yeah. Like there's no such thing as a simple event, I guess. But, and the other thing is, so you're saying that the whole effort of finding fault and locating the blame and meditating on it or whatever detracts from solving problems, right?
Right. And I feel like I experienced this recently at work where like I presented a, in the moment, like within the scope of what we were trying to do, it was pretty small. I was like, I can fix this pretty easily. And I had to like thoroughly explain it to somebody, to my manager, who like didn't really understand what was going on. And so like they were like, I don't understand. So then we had to bring in another person, and it like became this big thing. And then she was at the end, we just like explained what we could do, like what the problem was, what we could do to solve it. And we're like, it's not that hard. But the manager was like, well, whose fault is this? And both me and the other person were like, you could investigate that. It's going to take forever because there like are a million points where this could have gone wrong.
Right.
So just like, do you want it to be fixed or not?
I think the important thing with fault is considering where it is or isn't healthy. I think a certain degree of accountability and, you know, feeling fault in your own actions is health, like helps you achieve things better, helps you be accountable. And that, like in a workplace environment, there are like usually systems in place for this, or there should be, or whatever. Like, and I'm trying to think if this was just like an Apple thing. I think it was a thing at other tech companies too. A concept of what's it called? The acronym was DRI. Direct Responsibility Individual, I think. And the concept is basically that like for a project, you have like the one person who is responsible, so that like on an org chart level or whatever, you can like, if it is positive, you can give them the praise. If it's negative, you can give them the blame
and the critique so that they can fix it.
Right, exactly.
That's what I find is the one like upside of tracking down like the cause of something, if you can.
But that's like, it's the root of all reasons why we try to do it. But like, I feel like most of the time it's kind of like, it just makes you feel bad and you don't move forward.
That's why I don't do it anymore.
I think it is in general healthy for organizations to do that. And like, but I think at the point where you're like, okay, we have a solution, let's go fix it. No, but we need to find who's to blame for, like, I can see how, especially in the moment like that, that's why, what's it called? The postmortems are a thing. You like analyze the causes after it's a thing. That's why it's post.
Right. That's why we were like, I mean, we can alert the appropriate teams who can go investigate how this happened, but like we can also solve it before.
Right. Totally.
It doesn't have to be this thing.
Solve the problem.
And sometimes it's necessary to do that, like, because just like solving the problem in the here and now, like the local problem, might come up again so often that like you're not actually solving the bigger problem, which is what you do by finding the cause, alerting the right people and holding them accountable because they are the fault owner or whatever.
Right.
But what I was kind of thinking was, in regards to fault and the debriefer and stuff, is that like there is that one offhand comment that Rika has that she's like, oh, this wouldn't have happened if we hadn't come back. But like no one else blames them.
That is not true.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Nobody else blames like the tamers, but like Hypnos takes a lot of blame.
That's true.
In this.
But like I feel like I almost was like a little uncomfortable because like I feel like the tamers should have some blame for this, and that like they should, I guess I wish that they had some kind of narrative like them coming to accept that blame or like overcoming it or something.
I think it
came back because like the Deer Reaver came back with them. If they hadn't gone to the digital world, then I mean, we're doing the like finding the cause, and we just said it was kind of futile. But one thing I forgot to mention before, talking about like whether finding cause is like always kind of impossible, like that's an inherent problem in history, like in an accounting history. Like the whole like telling history is a matter of like telling stories of cause and effect, which any historian telling you is not actually possible.
Right.
But it's still important to do in a weird way, which I don't.
Well, it's important because they don't find one cause. They try to account.
Yeah.
Good historians will try to account for everything that was going on.
Right, it's not one digestible
format.
I think Tamers is being better than you are being. Like, it is being, like, the monster makers are the ones who feel the most blame for this and are also the ones trying to, like, put aside that to be like, fine, we need to fix the D-Reaper, which is exactly where the cyclic nature, I think, of this comes in.
I guess when I say, like, the Tamers should be more to blame, I did not mean, like, I think that it's their fault, like, and I personally blame them, but just, like, in the context of this world, it would make more logical sense for them to be the target of blame. And I was like, it's weird how that has not happened. But
I think we're conflating blame and guilt also. Like, the public, if you're talking about public blame, the public doesn't know about the kids, really, right?
So sure, like, sure, but like none of
that makes sense.
But none of the parents and the hypnosis people, I guess, because they all have other kinds. They have other things that they feel guilty about.
I just disagree so much because I feel like a government organization that was doing things behind the public's back that clearly, like, somewhat directly evolved into this thing is much more of a public target than children who were playing a game and happen to stumble into this mess and are trying to fix it. Like,
I'm not talking about public blame. I'm not talking about, like, the news saying it's these kids' fault. I'm talking about the show addressing the, like, I don't know. I guess I don't know who would do it, but...
Well, also, like, the kids went to the digital world to fight the sovereign, right? Or whatever they did.
which was not the true enemy.
Right.
They're not the true enemy.
And the sovereign was rebelling against humans.
Hypnos, mostly.
Hypnos.
Right?
So, like, the kids are cleaning up the adults' problems. I really don't think the kids have much share of blame in this at all.
I'm not trying to argue that it is their fault.
But, like, who is supposed to do it? I don't understand.
I don't see any guilt towards the kids at all, really.
Yeah, I guess I also don't know quite who would do it, because the parents are obviously too invested in loving their kids to be like, and it's your fault.
Like, you just keep saying the show, and I'm like, well, who in the show would do it? Like, I don't understand.
Well, I guess the kids, I would expect maybe to have a little bit more self-guilt about
it. They have more than enough,
really. I feel like they have plenty.
I'm like, I looked at Rika looking at the TV like, oh my god, it wouldn't have come if we didn't blah blah blah, and I was like, no, it would have come anyway. It hates humans.
they never questioned the idea of, like, should we not have gone to the digital world?
No, because they had to, because Digimon were coming through.
Well, they had to save Calamon. They stopped coming through.
Oh, yeah. I forgot that's what they were doing.
I guess what I mean, like, once you follow that logic, it, like, terminates pretty quickly. And, like, yes, it was the right decision. We could not have accounted for this. I guess what I'm saying is, like, I think it would have been more logical if the show had addressed that.
No. I don't like, I guess this is me, like, I don't like guilt plot lines, really.
Even if it, like, is about overcoming that and showing that it is...
Nope.
Yeah, I just feel like this whole arc was about everybody coming to terms with, like, okay, it's not my fault, or even if it is, like, I have to get over it and stop being guilty about it.
Yeah.
Rather than the introduce new things that they feel bad about. Like, we're almost to the end of the show. I just didn't have time for that. And, like, I don't think I wanted it to be honest. I think that basically summarizes my whole argument. And yeah, I mean, initially this topic was supposed to be about the distinction between destiny and fate, because it does seem like...
No, I think that's arbitrary word choice.
No, because I thought, like, if you look up things, it's like fate is, like, some definitions are fate is brought down from a higher being, which is like, okay, the sovereigns gave them the power to, like, fulfill their fate. Like, Doberman is the one who...
And destiny isn't?
Yeah, no, apparently destiny is the one that is not, is what? Like, destiny is like... well, now I don't remember. It's, like, destiny is about the final... Like, fate is, like, divine, plus it's the series of events that, like, it's all the chains of events, whereas destiny is apparently more concerned about just the final destination.
That makes sense.
Which the show only really portrays with Jerry, so I was like, okay, there seems to be, like, the show is trying to go for that, but then I feel like it got, like, something about it got muddled in my mind, where I was like, I don't want to go there.
I think it especially makes sense with, I think... In Japanese, Leomon's last line is like, this is my destiny. Like, this is, but I think also that word that he uses translates to both destiny and fate, which is why I'm like,
Is it Hitsuzen?
I think it's Unme, but I'm not sure.
Oh, that makes sense too.
I think Hitsuzen is a lot more dramatic.
Yes, I think so.
No, Hitsuzen just means inevitable.
Oh, whatever. Same concept.
Yeah.
Same concept. And then I don't know, I just thought maybe there was an interesting commentary on transhumanism happening with biomerging and Chaos Jerry.
Chaos Jerry.
Opposite ends of the spectrum of what transhumanism...
Oh, yeah, they are kind of opposite ends of the...
Of what transhumanism could lead to. I don't know how that had to do with Fault and Fate, but there was a lot of things that my brain brought into this that I was like, that is not related, brain. Please do not talk anymore. It's interesting, brain, but it's not related.
One thing I want to follow up was like my poo-pooing or dissing the idea of like fate and destiny being different. Like, I guess I'm talking at the word level and the concepts. Yes, when you point out the concept of like one thing being a final destination, one thing being a predetermination of every step up until the, like every step, including and up until the final destination. Those are very distinct concepts. Those are distinct concepts, which I agree is worth discussing the difference between them. But the words, I'm still like, right. Words are arbitrary and stupid, but.
Okay. I guess, yeah, like on a word level, I think.
We can use them both. We can use like both of those words to mean both of those meanings in English.
Yes.
Without stretching things too far.
Did Jeff discover linguistics recently or something?
I don't know.
Semiotics?
No. I think it's that we both were like thinking through topics that were very word related.
I guess.
Mine just started with Fault and then spun out of all the things.
I'm not sure what you expected. You're the one that's living with an English major here.
Yeah. I think the thing that made me back off from the distinction between fate and destiny was that I didn't get the sense that Doberman meant like every step along the way had led to the kid's fate being that they have to like defeat the D-Reaper, and that also implies that that's like the end step. So then I was like, I don't know anymore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, so I still think there's the like things you looked up that were like fate can only mean this one thing, destiny claiming this one thing. I'm like, that's not how words work.
That's whatever.
Not how words work.
I'm done. Hey, set my dead point and then you care. I never more at that you keep that you.
強く大きくなるために僕も走り出そう So I just want to talk about the D-Reaper, and one thread I've running through this is horror, but it's not the only thing I want to talk about. D-Reaper in general.
Okay.
All D-Reaper. So first point I had is kind of a side note, but I just want to get out of the way because it frustrated me. I think the idea of anything that touches a D-Reaper is deleted is like super compelling and threatening and dangerous and scary. And I guess I'm always frustrated when that's not how it actually works, even though they kind of portray that it is, and they're worried that it is, and then it does not. And then, so in specific, like the specific instance I thought of is I think at the end of the first episode's arc, when they like meet all the, little D-Reaper agents and like, no, Gilmon, don't touch it, cause you might get deleted. And then they later fight it and like block attacks, and they block an attack, and like the attack clearly hit like Wargromon's arms or like blades, or like the blades will then cut the D-Reaper, and it's like, well, that's physical contact, and there's no deleting happening.
Didn't they explain that like he just works differently in the real world?
They did explain that, and my trouble right now is I can't remember what we talked about in the last episode, but I feel like I presented a similar argument back then, which was like even in the digital world they set it up as like it deleted everything it touched, but I think there were times when they touched it through physical attacks, but I can't remember. So yeah, I guess without that being the case, what you're saying makes sense, so I may selectively edit this out anyway. So the next thing I want to talk about was, it's not a name I don't think ever is mentioned in the show, but the description. So I want to talk about the different D-Reaper agents. I think they do say agent in the show. They do say like agent of D-Reaper. But so I mainly get information from Kanaka's notes on the D-Reaper, and there it like spells things out very specifically and refers to them as ADR, agents of D-Reaper, and gives them different code names and stuff. So this is a, so we're going to have Ash read because Ash is good at reading. So this is from, and we'll have links to also these notes in the show notes so you can find them. But this is Kanaka describing the, I guess, the design process for the various agents.
All right. I thought that the enemy in the final story arc should be an entity that is neither Digimon nor human, and thus created the D-Reaper. While trying to think of how to render this entity, I thought of the celebrated team of designers that Digimon Tamers boasted. There was Mr. Kenji Watanabe, originator of the Digimon Virtual Pet and Game. There was Mr. Katsuyoshi Nakatsuru, designer of the human characters. There was Mr. Shinji Aramaki, CG designer, as well as a mechanic and character designer. I believe that if these three were to use their imagination and construct the D-Reaper in competition with each other, an enemy character unlike any ever seen before would be born.
I think that's a really cool story of just like putting these different designers in competition to make the different agents, and like it explains why they are so different, and yeah, I think it's pretty cool.
Which one of them came up with the blob?
I don't know if the blob is considered, but that was probably, I'm going to tie into that because that blob is one element of an important thing later. But I'm guessing that the blob was specified by Kanaka himself, but I don't think it says it anywhere. So now I want to talk about the actual, like, each one of the different agents. We have a link in the show notes to the Digimon Wiki page that has the different images of these agents. Because the names are not logical. Like, I don't think from just watching the show, you would really connect to these names at all, but we'll try to describe each one of them. So the first one is the ADR-02. 01 is Jerry, because that's like the first form it makes. But if you look up images of ADR-01 Jerry, it's like her final form, which I haven't got to yet. So we're going to skip that for now. So starting with ADR-02 is Searcher. And it's those little things that, like, the army encountered and that they, like, Gilman wanted to touch or whatever. The little scout thingies. They're pretty cool. They're pretty creepy. Any thoughts?
I kind of like them.
They're kind of cute. They're like little hands.
These are the ones that Terrierman said he would know if it was a Digimon, right? I'm looking at it and I'm like, it kind of looks like a Digimon.
I don't even remember that line.
I think it was.
I don't remember these guys actually attacking, but it does list attacks on the Digimon Wiki, so.
I don't really remember them attacking either. I just remember them, like, flying around.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe that's from the card. It has a card.
Yeah. I guess also looking at an image of one of them doesn't really, in the show, we'll have an image in the show notes of how they normally portray, which is like a swarm of them, which is also pretty cool and threatening, even though they're, like, clearly not attackers. Next one is ADR-03, Pendulum Feet. And I think this is the one they fight as ultimates, and it keeps, like, throwing back their attacks at it. It's what necessitates Beelzebub coming in, because they can't beat his ultimates. And it's called Pendulum Feet because I guess, like, its feet are little pendulums, but, like, that's not a design element that even stuck out to me from watching the show.
I didn't notice.
Yeah, no.
It's pretty creepy. It looks like a Halloween costume gone a little wrong.
Just a little bit. Yeah. I really like the floating face balls. Those are, like, satisfyingly creepy.
That thing's pretty creepy. The next one I don't even remember. You're going to have to help me jog my memory. You do remember it? So this is ADR-04, Bubbles. Why is it called Bubbles?
There were some, like, when they first meet Doberman and Alice, I think that there were some, that's what they were fighting.
I see. Okay, that makes sense. When they're fighting, but were they able to beat them as ultimates? I'm trying to place the power levels.
It says they are rather weak and easily destroyed, so I assume yes.
I mean, and they immediately do their biomerge.
Right. Yeah. And so once they biomerge, the thing I remember them fighting after they biomerged is ADR-05, Creep Hands, which that at least makes sense because they have giant hands.
Yeah.
And they walk around on hands.
I feel bad that he has, like, a, you know, it's just like, yeah, we just didn't feel like creating the bottom half of your body. We just gave you ribs.
He reminds me of an angel from Evangelion.
Yeah.
A lot of these things do feel very Evangelion.
Yeah, I mean, even just, like, in reading the name, like, ADR-0 blank sounds very ADR-0
like
blank.
Eva unit. Yeah.
There was a Reddit post not a couple of days ago, as of the time of this recording, that I think it's probably a week ago, that was basically like, I think it was like, I just watched Digimon Tamers and, oh my god, it's Eva. Here are all the reasons it's Eva. And I was like, no, some of these are such big stretches. But this one thing is very close to Eva.
Yeah.
Okay, and the last one that we encountered is ADR-06 Horn Striker, or aka Green Goblin. The only way I can place these is colors.
I'm surprised you noticed it was green. Yeah.
Yeah, that is true. It's green enough.
But yes, it is green.
Yeah, this one is particularly weird because it is very humanoid and is the most Digimon-ish, I think. Still not very Digimon-y.
I mean, it's got the same color scheme as Snimon, I guess.
I guess it's almost too humanoid to be Digimon-y.
I'm trying to think of what it reminds me of. Yeah. It, like, reminds me of something, but I can't place what it is.
Reminds me of G.I. Joe.
Oh, that's not it.
The pose is making this image is kind of like, yeah, it's like a hunched over, muscly man, kind of. But yeah, this is the one that appears after they've biomerged, and, like, they're struggling with, and then Justimon helps them distract it while they go into the the core to, or they go into the D Reaper to find Takato.
Yeah.
It, one, a theme that runs through my frustration with the D Reaper is like, they always keep attacking the agent instead of the cable.
Yeah, I was just about to say, like, why don't they always attack the cable?
Right. I'll just go for the cable.
It's because they're stupid 10-year-olds.
So those are different agents. Now I wanted to get into the D Reaper and Cosmic Horror, which is, I think Cosmic and Lovecraftian Horror is thrown around a lot when talking to the D Reaper. And kind of my premise, this is more than it should, I think. What I bolded here was, would anyone say this if they didn't know that Kanaka was clearly a big Lovecraft fan? And I don't know if they would. This is from Wikipedia, the description of what love, like a general description of Lovecraftian, the hallmarks of Lovecraftian horror.
The hallmark of Lovecraft's work is cosmicism, the sense that ordinary life is a thin shell over a reality that is so alien and abstract in comparison that merely contemplating it would damage the sanity of the ordinary person. Lovecraft's work is also steeped in the insular feel of rural New England, and much of the genre continues to maintain this sense that that which man was not meant to know might be closer to the surface of ordinary life outside of the crowded cities of modern civilization.
Yeah, and so I think Dagomon/Dragomon/Sasha Dark Ocean, the Lovecraftian roots of those are much clearer and indisputable. I mean, Dagomon is like literally designed from Cthulhu. So like, it's like almost impossible to deny there. And they name, like, he named the town and like these little references, like there's a bit of digicode Kyrox by that like is a, like, I forget what it exactly says, but it's like a really creepy like line from Lovecraftian literature. So anyway, that's very clear. The D Reaper, I just don't know so much. So here are some of the common themes of, this is from the same article on Lovecraftian or cosmic horror. Here are some common themes of Lovecraftian horror, which I really don't think fit this so well, or fit the D Reaper so well.
Anti-anthropocentrism,
Oh, I hate these words.
I can't do it now. Misanthropy?
I was confused with misanthropy because I was like, isn't that like, I was getting confused with misandry?
Oh no.
Yeah.
Slightly different things. Anti-anthropocentrism, misanthropy in general. Lovecraft's works tend not to focus on characterization of humans, in line with his view of humanity's insignificant place in the universe, and the general modernist trend of literature at the time of his writings. Detachment. Lovecraftian heroes, both in the original writings and in more modern adaptations, tend to be isolated individuals, usually with an academic or scholarly intent. Helplessness and hopelessness. Although Lovecraftian heroes may occasionally deal a setback to malignant forces, their victories are temporary, and they usually pay a price for it. Otherwise, subjects often find themselves completely unable to simply run away, instead driven by some other force to their desperate end.
I guess
misanthropy? Misanthropy?
I don't know. I do want to define misanthropy, or like help people, because like, I did not know. It's like
it's when you hate people.
Right, hate all people. And I was getting confused with misandry, which is hating men.
Hating men.
Right.
Yes.
So for a second, I was like, oh, why is this talking about MRA bullshit? But anyway, yes. So I think you could, so my point was kind of like, these themes don't really fit Tamers very well. But I guess you could argue that the line about victories usually is a price for them could fit Leomon more than most other seasons of Digimon. But usually there's a cost for, that's just like part of narrative structure of most dramatic storytelling. So,
yeah.
And also like it says their victories are temporary and have a price. Whereas like, I feel like the Arc of Tamers is not a temporary victory. It's a, we rout the D Reaper, it's gone. Yay.
Right. Yeah. And I don't see this as particularly Lovecraftian.
So there were two themes that fit. Here they are.
Preoccupation with viscerate texture. The horror features. That's a great word. The horror features of Lovecraft stories tend to involve protean semi-gelatinous substances, such as slime, as opposed to standard horror elements, such as blood, bones, or corpses. Unanswered questions. Characters in Lovecraft stories rarely, if ever, fully understand what is happening to them, and often go insane if they try.
Yeah, so I think the what I was talking about before when you mentioned the who designed the blob, I'm like, well, that seems like this semi-gelatinous substance, such as slime. And also, that answer questions. There's not too much, like, D Reaper, a lot of the D Reaper is explained, but there is a lot, I have a, Well, I'll just link to it on this because like, this is a pretty long summation, but there's Kanaka's another page that lists like basically his original planning and thoughts of the D-Reaper. And the important part is that there's all this history behind it. And it's like, he, you know, started in this year based on this project, blah, 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 blah. But then there's also this like, it was dormant for several years and no one knows how it evolved in that time. And it kind of ends on this note. What does it say? It says, it may not even be a part of the world that humans created. It can be theorized that there may have been some connection to another world, a different dimension separate from the real world and digital world that gave it, like, helped it evolve or whatever. So there's clearly this element to the D-Reaper that is, like, a lingering mystery of how it became so advanced in the time since they last saw it. But my conclusion from this is that, like, the D-Reaper itself is very detached from humanity, and it's, like, a very humanless existence. So, like, the D-Reaper itself, I think, is a kind of Lovecraftian villain, but the way it is eventually dealt with and the story around it and the struggle in general, like, the struggle is a very human struggle. It's, like, Jerry, like, one of the points was about how it's not, there's, like, this story, Lovecraftian stories are not interested in human emotions and human characterization. And it's, like, the things on the D-Reaper are, like, very invested in that. You know, it's, like, very much about Jerry's grief. And it's very much, like, about that very human struggle and very human emotions, which was completely contradictory to these Lovecraftian elements.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's about the strength of humanity over misanthropy, not about, well, anyway. So yeah, I think the D-Reaper is a Lovecraftian villain, but the story itself is very non-Lovecraftian. And yeah, I kind of wonder if Kanaka, in, you know, accepting this project to, like, do a Digimon season, because, like, I feel like it's impossible to make a Digimon season that is Lovecraftian, right? Like, to make it about, yeah, like, hopelessness and...
Yeah, the good guys have to win.
You think it is possible, Ashley?
I'm just confused. Like, I don't think anybody is ever arguing that Tamers is Lovecraftian. I think they're always just arguing that the D-Reaper is the D-Reaper itself is Lovecraftian. I thought the whole point of this topic was going to be that that's not true, and then that's not what it was. So now I'm like, what?
I guess I just feel like, I think the Lovecraftiness of the villain is completely undercut if the story is still about how it is possible to vanquish it, you know? Like, if the villain is this, like, completely humanless threat that is, like, ever-present and, like, but if you can still vanquish it in the end, I'm like, well, that kind of defeats the purpose of those cosmic horror elements. I don't know if you can, like, oh, I don't know. I guess it just, to me, it feels like it kind of dulls that blade.
I mean, sure, I would agree that you can never make a Digimon season that is, like, actually Lovecraftian. I just don't know why we had to go through all the D-Reaper parts if the argument was like, yeah, the D-Reaper itself is still Lovecraftian.
So, yeah, I guess I'll keep an eye out for, like, when I hear people talk about Tamers being Lovecraftian, keep an eye out for, like, are they really talking about the season, the villain? But, yeah, I don't know. 羽をもらった勇気たち強く大きくなるために僕も走り出そう So this first commercial is for episode. Also, we're getting to the end of these commercials. There's only one more set after this, and I was like, there must be commercials. There must have been commercials for the Tamers movies when they aired them dubbed on ABC Family, and I could not find them at all, and I'm really sad. And so we're near the end of having commercials about Digimon to talk about. But yes, this is for episode 43. Good? Who said good?
Me.
Ah, oh, okay. Episode 43.
Next on Fox Kids, the action kicks off with a brand new Digimon.
Bring it on!
It's all out war when the Tamers face the ultimate terror. Then all new for you, the 1-hour season finale of Metabots.
I got Metabots!
Next, catch an all new Digimon, followed by the 1-hour season finale of Metabots after a brand new Power Rangers Wild Force on Fox Kids.
I'm sorry, I'm way more excited to watch the 1-hour season finale of Metabots.
Yeah, I mean, the Digimon commercial, half of that was not, it was like, okay, that there was nothing ridiculous about it, there was nothing silly about it, it was like, yeah, that they seemed like an effective dramatization of an episode. But Metabots, mm-hmm. I like how they said, like, new for you, and I was like, what are you saying? Is like, I guess they were just trying new to emphasize, it sounded like they kind of, you know, they can't say new because it was actually in Japan years ago or something, but I assume it wasn't like years prior in Japan, but it felt like a, like, fine print. Anyway, the next one is for episodes 45 and 46. And there are missing ones here, because I couldn't find any for episode 44 or 42. But anyway, so this is for the last two from this arc.
Next on Fox Kids, two new Digimon adventures.
Let's do it before it's too late.
First,
all humans and Digimon are to be deleted immediately.
The time for talking's over!
Defiance is pointless.
This ends right now!
That's not Jerry!
Then,
If this is Jerry.
Jerry, you don't look so good.
Who is this?
Your fears will be your downfall.
You want to fight? Bring it on.
Find out on two all-new exciting episodes of Digimon next on Fox
Kids. I mean, okay. Whatever, commercials.
I think that was also, like, you know,
that was pretty straight.
Fair, but, like, dramatic, yeah.
Simplification. But sure.
Like, if this is Jerry, then who is this?
Who is this? I don't know.
Your fears will be your downfall. Sorry. That voice scared me too.
Being a Digimon tamer is so new to me. I have so many unanswered questions.
Is Henry's sensei his grandfather or not? Like, what is going on there?
I don't know.
Like, that is unanswered.
But they did, like, there was a line where, like, John Yu was talking to his wife and said, like, it sounds like I'm talking to my father, right? Like, they said that it's John Yu's father, right?
He said, if I didn't know any better, I'd think that you handed the phone to my father or something. But it was after his sensei started talking, yeah.
Okay, so I guess it could have been a totally different, like, that doesn't mean that that guy who was there is the father. But why would they be staying with him?
Maybe because it's a small, the Chinese community in Japan, in Shinjuku, is small enough that...
That's a good point. Yeah, that's true.
Speaking of Henry, when Rika and Takato go in to the D-Reaper in their biomerged forms, everybody is afraid. But when Henry does it, nobody seems to care. And I'm like, why is Henry not affected by the D-Reaper? That doesn't... What?
Don't they not get de-evolved because of the Tsukuyomon's shield?
Well, Tsukuyomon had Tsukuyomon's shield too.
I don't remember. Yeah. You're saying people were concerned? I'm confused.
Well, Tsukuyomon started flickering out.
Oh, I don't remember that. That's weird.
Yeah. Huh. Like, it was definitely implied, like, Takato and Giyomon Ungallantmon. there was definitely an implication that, like, Rika and Tsukuyomon was, like, affected by it. And then just Henry just waltzes over and is like, yeah, whatever.
Well, maybe because of the stress of maintaining the Tsukuya shields. I don't know.
Yeah, stretching. Doberman's gift. Just...
What was that? Yeah.
Okay.
Great gift, guys.
I have a question. Why didn't we ever hear about Henry beating up some neighborhood kids before? Like, yeah, that would have been really useful for understanding his character path.
Exactly. It was like, this is logical to bring up, but it should have been episode 4. You know, like...
Yeah. Yeah.
I was okay with it.
It's like, I guess at the time they explained that he was a pacifist with Terrymon because Terrymon got hurt before. But I was like,
this is much more compelling. Yeah,
this is the real reason.
Yeah.
So I the one way I kind of justified that in my head was that, like, this is the one of the first times that it's like Henry himself being involved in the fighting. You know, it's not about his friend fighting, it's about himself fighting. But still, it seems like that would have affected his entire worldview before. And
Yeah.
I am worried about Doberman's gift, though. I'm not done with that.
Sorry.
No. I'm not blaming you. I'm blaming the gift. Okay. I liked Henry. It was Henry's theory, but I liked the idea of the reason they can't digivolve in the real world to buy them. They can't go to Mega is because of this, like, mechanics-based thing that is logical. It's not like a Deus Ex Machina thing, like when they couldn't do it in the digital world. Kind of like a motionless thing like it is with the digicores of like, oh, you can't do it, and now you digicore, now you can do it, cool. It's logical, it's good. But then the solution for it completely contradicts all that, because it's just like, the reason you can't digivolve is because it's the real world. And there's like, oh, but you got a gift, now you can do it. And it's like, or the reason is that you're not both data anymore. And then there's just a gift, and now you can. And it's like, so you can biomerge in the real world if you have a gift or if you're data. Like, So the one way I tried to justify it was that I've been trying to practice Japanese, listening to the episodes in Japanese. Like, I made a, like, podcast of the Japanese audio, and I was listening to that episode, and I totally misunderstood it. It's not what they say. Like, what they say in Japanese, what Doberman says, is very, I think it's, like, very similar. It's, like, a pretty literal translation, what they use in the dub. But what I thought I heard was Doberman saying, like, the gift is a part of the digital world. Like, this is the gift of the digital world or something.
That's cool.
Right, like, the, which is not what he said, but it's a headcanon that makes sense. Yeah, it's a headcanon that makes sense to me because it's like, you know, giving some like a bridge almost of digital world data or something that would help facilitate things make sense. Yeah, yeah. How did Calamon get back from Matsumoto? Did Calamon just ride on the train for 3 hours on his own?
Probably.
Like Jerry,
I don't know.
Jerry, I assume, is magic and like teleported or something, but Calamon just like shows up.
I assume he was following her.
I guess that makes sense if you assume that, you know, Jerry actually, you know, took a train. Because I assume that Jerry transported. Because, like, they say that Jerry got there faster than a train could have.
Yeah, she, like, appeared there. I think Calamon took the train.
Oh, wait, no, I'm confused because, no, that is justified because there's Jerry stuck in the kernel and the D-Reaper Jerry. So, like, Jerry stuck in the kernel may not have actually gotten to Matsumoto. Like, when Takato says, like, I saw Jerry and it was, like, last night, but she only disappeared last night, that could be explained because the Jerry that eventually is in the kernel wasn't back yet, but the D-Reaper agent version was. That makes sense. And the Jerry eventually got there and then went into the kernel. But anyway, Rio. Why is he the worst?
Do we have to talk about him?
Well, okay. So
why is he the worst?
There are lots of unanswered questions. And just like, he learned to bioemerge on his own. Like, what? and he also, like, he shows up with bioemerge ability. Supposedly, like, I mean, I guess you could, okay, not being affected by Doberman's gift either. And you can, okay, if you say that, like, okay, maybe Doberman's gift was a thing that, like, affected the entire world. And it wasn't just localized to the beams of light that they clearly showed being in the center of the force, but
well, maybe Rio is digital.
Maybe he's just stupid.
Now you're catching
I'm
on.
I'm not sure there's a maybe about that.
Yeah.
Oh.
Also, I wrote down Rio stop hitting on Susie because that's gross and weird.
Did no one else get that?
When does he hit on Susie?
He like gives her a card. He gives her a modified card. He's like, it's your first modified card.
I did not.
I think that's just
weird
him.
Vibes from that.
Yeah, I didn't get like weird romantic vibes from that. I just think that's part of his like, I'm a nice guy. I'm nice to little children.
Yeah.
I'm Rio.
That and like, oh, he's an avatar of the digital world franchise. Here, have a card. Buy some more.
Yeah, buy more cards.
Yeah, basically.
And like, you know, he's a plot device.
Well,
I think she's going to use that card later and it's going to be important. So I was like, all right, that makes sense for Rio to be giving it. He's a big fat plot device.
What is frustrating now when I look back on it is that like it would have made a lot of sense for Rio to be the one who brought the gift, you know, like to have been sent by the sovereigns and to like instead of everyone's stupid. It's all bad. Everything's bad. Digimon was a mistake.
Delete Digimon.
That's what the D-Reaper's trying to do.
We're
on the same page.
Yeah. Okay, wait. I don't know if this is an unanswered question so much as I was confused by it, but like, when Impmon back in the day, like the scene that they show of him watching I and what's her face? Tear apart the teddy bear. I was like, but that was like a thing that was happening right then, and they didn't know that he was there, right? Or like, what?
Yeah,
completely misread that scene?
No, so there's a scene they show early on the show with him like watching them from afar, right? Watching from outside the window.
Yeah.
And they tear up the teddy bear. And yeah, that doesn't make sense on that level. I think there are a couple of different ways you can make it make sense, which is like it's a thing that happened frequently. So there would have been a time when Impmon was there where like they would have seen it getting torn up. Also, I forget exactly what. So the problem, right, is that like they refer to it as like, look, Impmon, we fixed it. And like they make it seem like Impmon cared about being broken up. There are also kids who might not know, like have the awareness of like who is around for different things in their life, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So my implication is that it doesn't make sense.
Stray Bits, this is where we talk about random things that we didn't get to mention before.
So, I believe that there is a picture in which, I guess I don't know when it, like, Yamaki, Riley, and Tally go to get the kids from Takato's parents place or whatever after they make bread.
Okay, so this image will be in the show notes, right? You have the image. Okay, good. This image will be in the show notes.
I have the image. Yeah. I mean, I took the screenshot. So, like, then they run to, like, go fight the D-Reaper or something. And there's a shot where, like, one adult is behind each of the kids. So Takato's in front, and then it's Yamaki, then it's Henry, and Riley is behind him, and Rika with Tally behind her. And I think that that proves that Rika is third string on this team, because in the hierarchy of the adults, it is clearly Yamaki, Riley, Tally.
Oh, and this confirms my long-running theory that the kids are not actually real characters, and they're just puppets of the hypnotized characters. I had that for a while, but I didn't have the right evidence to really piece it together. But now you've really solidified it.
Jeffrey, I know you think you're funny with your little reductionist arguments, like there weren't other evidence things that we've brought up before for this, and this isn't just another piece that confirms it, but like, whatever.
Blah, 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 blah. Sexism is a series of tiny cuts. Blah, 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 blah.
Uh-huh. Doberman is totally not a Houndoom ripoff.
That's apparently a Pokemon. I don't remember what that Pokemon looks like. It is just a Dober. Isn't that like, what's the name of the dog? It's a Doberman dog. It's
yes.
It's not a very...
Yeah, but in...
Okay, I'm gonna go. You know that you read the thing. Okay, I'm gonna go on to my topic about Alice and Doberman then. Alice. So if you read Kanaka's notes, I'll link to the page in the show notes that talks about Alice. He describes that the origin for Alice was that there was a design contest in V-Jump, the manga and news magazine where, like, lots of Digimon news and stuff, and where V-Tamer was published and stuff like that. Anyway, there was a contest in there for creating Digimon, and Doberman was a result of that. So it was created by a fan, and he needed to incorporate it in the story, and so he decided to have it be the messenger who brings the gift of bioemerging. And then he thought of Alice as, what kind of partner would this kind of Digimon have? And he was like, well, I think it'd look cool if it was a goth girl. So that's how he created that.
I have so many problems with this.
But so my main point was that, like, it explains that Doberman is such a basic, like, it's just a kind of dog design. But,
sure.
Yes.
Okay. I don't know why Doberman had to have a partner, to be honest.
Yeah, it doesn't really, like... it doesn't really make sense. Like, it doesn't really seem like they have, like, the mechanics of, like, it doesn't seem like she was with him in the digital world. It seemed like she came... She was there and, like, got a partner and then lost a partner right away. So, like,
exactly.
Why?
There's no emotional resonance for that. Like,
it's just like, and I think the whole, like, so the translated page on Kanako's website says, the image that rose to my mind was a young girl in gothic clothing. And I think that is, like, inherent in that, like, oh, and a young girl in gothic clothing, like, suffering and being sad. And I'm like, I feel like the main reason that there had to be Tamer was so that someone would be really sad when it was lost. And I'm like, oh, don't like that.
I know.
Yep.
Okay, I do follow Asher's thoughts from earlier more in that women, I think I was thinking about it incorrectly. Not that women make sacrifices, like something else is sacrificed normally, but like women are normally the actual sacrifice.
Oh, yeah. That is
absolutely a thing.
Yeah.
Although this kind of breaks that, because I mean, Doberman is dude voice.
But I don't get, like, Doberman seems perfectly happy to do this, to be honest.
Yeah.
And Alice is the one who lives with the sadness.
Yeah, but usually, like, living with the sadness is, like, you know, the male superhero lives with the sadness of their mother, wife, whatever, dying.
Yeah, but then they get to do things about it.
Sure.
Alice is not going to do anything.
Right, all I'm saying is that, like, yeah, usually women are the ones that are sacrificed. But here, that is not the case right here. But, like, the trend is still totally exists.
I think the problem is still that, like, yeah, Alice has no agency. Like, Doberman is still the one who had all the agency and power.
Yeah.
And Alice is just, like, sad girl.
So more on Alice. I'm curious if everyone else thought about this. How obvious was it to you, and when did it become obvious, or whatever, that she was Rob McCoy / Dolphin's granddaughter?
I think I didn't notice until, like, they blatantly showed the picture.
I didn't realize she was his granddaughter.
Yeah, I thought it was his daughter, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm gonna get to that. So it seemed fairly subtle at first, because it was like he has a portrait while he's, like, being interviewed on TV, and he knocks it over while it's on TV. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's a portrait. I recognize Alice in that little portrait. And I was like, proud of myself. I'm like, oh, yeah, I caught the really subtle signal. And then there's like, they show the portrait again some more in the background of his desk. I'm like, oh, yeah, I caught the really cool signal. I'm so smart. I'm such a smart viewer. And then he just gets more and more explicit. Like, he holds the portrait. He, like, calls out Alice's name later. I'm like, okay, never mind. Never mind. This is totally.
I didn't actually see her in the portrait he knocked over. Like, I saw the guy who I assumed was her older brother, not her father.
That would make sense as an interpretation. Okay. I was so thoroughly confused by that, because there's the one picture where it's like, I guess what it's supposed to be is the first generation. Like, it's like him and his son that he was playing with around the time that they'd invented the Digimon in 1984. So like the son was like at the age of the Tamers in 1984. And then he grew up to have a kid, which he would have had to be really young, though, to, like, have someone about that age.
Like, yeah, no, she's, like, she's 10. No, I don't buy this.
I think Kanaka's notes or something say granddaughter, though.
Kanaka needs to check his math.
But anyway, so I was really confused because there's the one portrait with just the son, and then there's the other portrait with the son and the daughter. Saying older brother makes sense. I had not thought of that. I was just like, is that... I didn't make the connection that, like, the son was the older person in the other picture. I was like, is this, like, he had one son, and then he had a husband with a daughter at that point? I was so confused.
If only. Also, like, he's John Yu's age. He should not be old enough to have grandkids.
Yeah, like, whatever.
Yeah, it does say Alice is the granddaughter of Dolphin.
That is messed up.
Whatever. I don't buy that.
I mean, Rob McCoy is supposed to be the leader of the Wild Bunch / Monster Makers, supposedly, so maybe he's older than John Yu, but I don't know.
And I guess John Yu has older children, but they're not of child-rearing age.
Oh, no, sure, but, like, everyone has children of different age. Like, I didn't get the sense that, like, is Rob McCoy that much older than Seiko? Or younger? Like, I don't know. They may be similar age.
I don't know. Okay, I'll give the show points for making it, like, no, actually I won't, because they just made it weird. Like, they tried to make it subtle that it's, like, it's his granddaughter, not his daughter, but no.
But it doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter that it's the granddaughter instead of the daughter. So my recollection of Alice, I think this is partially because of something I'll get to later, my recollection of Alice was her existence and Doberman's existence being a very mysterious thing that is never really fully explained, and being, like, these lingering mysteries. But no, like, everything about Doberman is explained. It's just stupid. It just doesn't connect. It doesn't make sense. It's full of pothole. And the explanation that is given is, it just shortcuts all the logic that's been presented before. And everything that's in the show, like, neatly wraps up who this Alice person is. You know, they don't show, you know, like, her embracing Dolphin at the end. Or, like, they don't show, like, but, like, they make it very clear who she is related to, which isn't even necessary. She could be a random character, but they, like, explicitly show that she's related to someone. It's, like, it's really not much of a mystery, but there is a mystery. So, okay, so Ash, when you read, this is from Kanaka's notes on Alice.
Okay. The following is my own personal thoughts, not necessarily canonical or correct, but there is a scene in which Dolphin looks at a framed picture of his granddaughter and calls out her name. Although it is unusual in Japan to carry around pictures of loved ones, it was my understanding that it was quite natural for Westerners to take photos of family members with them on vacation. I had not imbued that scene with any special meaning. In the framed picture, Alice shows an innocent, childlike smile, but Dolphin, played by Mr. Masami Kikuchi in the Japanese, called out to Alice with great feeling in his voice. As I listened to the recorded dialogue, I got a strange feeling that perhaps, long before the story of Digimon Tamers had started, Alice had left this world. Mind you, this is just my own imagination. Oh, that's a cool mystery.
No, I want to point out that I read Kanaka's notes to try to figure out stuff about Jerry and Fault and, like, a bunch of things, and I was like, Kanaka is on crack. Like, this guy is BS all over the place. I hate him so much. Just, like, go to hell. Like, because I think, like, in the page that is supposed to be about Jerry, he just starts talking about Alice, and I'm like, okay, Alice is not that important, bro. Like, what are you doing?
Okay, yeah. But I mean, Alice, is a, like, so I don't know why. I don't know if it explains on that page, but like, it is an important name to him. Like, the Kanaka's website for tamers is kanaka.com/Alice6/tamers.
Right. That's what it started talking about, was like that there are a bunch of Alices in all the things that he makes. Yeah.
Oh.
But like on Jerry's page or something.
Jerry is a like a spiritual Alice.
Oh, yeah. I would like to point out that I think I started reading his notes because I came across this Tumblr that says somewhere in the notes that he had intended Jerry's parents to be involved in a sex trade.
What?
And how that... Okay, I'll read the Tumblr because I couldn't find it in the notes because they're all crack and not organized well.
That sounds like not true.
Yeah, that sounds fake.
It says, according to Kanaka's site, Jerry's parents were originally planned. That's what I thought, too. That's why I wanted to go and find out. And then I was like, this is not worth it. Planned to be involved in a sex trade, with her father being in charge of a prostitution organization and her mother being a prostitute herself. At some point, after the two met, they fell in love and accidentally conceived a baby girl by the name of Jerry. And then, so, like, it became sort of interesting because the whole thing tries to argue that, like, the D-Reaper, Jerry is in a womb and, like, the cords that are attached to the things are like umbilical cords, and like Jerry is sad that her mom died, and the D-Reaper like looks like the reproductive system of...
This is getting really evil.
None of this needs to be tied into sex workers. That sounds like a totally made up thing. Let's move on. We don't have much time. We really need to move on. Shibumi looks too much like Jesus. I don't like it. Too much Jesus. I mean, not that I don't like Jesus, but just like, it's weird. Like, is that intentional? I don't know. It's weird. They're still saying the true enemy, like it's a name, and I still hate it. I bolded and italicized that, my notes.
Good for you.
Okay. Ew, romantic tension between Takato and Rika. Get that out of there.
That was weird.
Yeah. Oh my God. I was like, what's happening right now?
So in case you don't remember, this is a scene where they're walking under the tunnel to get into Shinjuku because it's closed off by the army, the self-defense force, which is what it should actually be called, but they never call it that because people in America wouldn't understand that. But they're walking in the tunnel, and I forget exactly what they're talking about. Like, oh, Takato doesn't want to call out Rika's shirt because he's like afraid he's going to get beat up or whatever, but like, it's just awkward, and they blush and don't like it.
I like that Henry was like,
I'm just gonna stay out of this.
Okay. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
This is weird. Henry was all of us.
Yep.
Yeah, he really was.
So we reached the supposedly conclusive evidence that Lopmon is male in these episodes in Japanese. And I think it's bullshit. Ash, can you read this? So these notes. They said dub and sub blog that I really like. I'm not trying to target, like, I think their analysis is wrong. I think it's a common in, I think everyone kind of accepts this as the reason, and I don't think it's true, but...
In the original, Xiaocheng tries to break Lopmon of his archaic speech pattern to use more modern Japanese, and among her corrections is telling Lopmon to use boku for I instead of ware. What's particularly noticeable about this is that boku is a masculine-gendered pronoun, with the existence of modern pronouns in Japanese that happen to be gender neutral or feminine. Xiaocheng herself uses the feminine atashi. There is little reason for Xiaocheng to tell Lopmon to use this unless she's already aware he's male. As a result, the sequence indirectly reveals that Lopmon is male. The dub has the combination of having already established Lopmon as female and not using archaic language, and so Susie tries to get Lopmon to say defiant things like, do I have to, and I don't want to go to bed yet.
I don't want to go to bed yet. But yeah, okay. Let me find my notes. Where did I put this? All we know is that Xiaocheng really wants Lopmon to use very fairly male-specific pronouns, but not male-exclusive. Like, It is not unheard of for girls to use boku. The thing that immediately comes to mind is, what's her name? Ryuko in Kill la Kill uses boku.
Right, but I mean, it does...
Right.
Indicate, yeah.
That is like an extreme example of like a girl who is very like, I am manly kind of in the Japanese. I'm not saying that is.
Yeah. No, it kind of always does mean that.
But what frustrates me about this is that Susie Xiaocheng has a history of misgendering Terrorman. Like, it would not be out of the realm of possibility for her to force to say, like, you should use this pronoun without it being because you are a guy, you know, like...
Right.
Yeah, that was more my reading is, like, I don't know that necessarily trusting a person who is not the person who is speaking.
Yeah, yeah,
like
that's generally true.
To speak for their gender.
Right. Generally true, and someone who has a history of misgendering. Like,
yeah,
so,
okay.
Yeah.
That's more the argument I would go with here.
Yeah. But I mean, also, like, in the scale of, you know, like, shonen protagonist masculine pronouns, like, Boku isn't even, like, you know, Boku is closer to the neutral end. There's, like, there are more, I am manly pronouns. So, like,
right.
What this spells out is, like, oh, it is a masculine pronoun. I'm like, it's, like, the least masculine of the masculine pronouns, though, so... So, yeah.
I'm not going down this road. I'm going to stick with the...
Well, yeah, sure. Anyway, it's weak on multiple fronts. And again, not trying to criticize this one blog in particular. Just like, I think it's a commonly accepted reason. And anyway, I like how Ai and Mako have matured enough that they can give Mon the affection he needs. I really like the gender norms, though, of Ai is the girl and Mako is the guy. That Ai gives him a kiss while Mako gives him a gun. That's like, It's like, they're so young and they're already being like, well, this is the girl thing to do. This is the guy thing to do. And like, no, why? Yeah. And I'm curious what you guys think about it. Like, to some degree, I kind of feel like Mako's toy gun turning into an actual gun kind of undercuts the sweetness of the act. How do you guys feel?
Nah, I thought it was cool, actually.
Yeah, like that's the thing. I'm the conflict because I'm like, it kind of undercuts it, but it's also just cool. Like, and I think it also it turns a small gesture into a big gesture, which I think makes the motion more accessible. Kind of like it. Everyone can resonate with, like, oh, that's cool, more than they would, like, oh, that's sweet. I don't know. Actually, what were you going to say?
No, I still think it's sweet. I think it's...
If it hadn't turned into anything, it would have just been, like, okay. Like, you would have quickly forgot about that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the thing. Like, whereas it's a memory that lingers, it lingered with me, at least, like, because it's important to his arsenal. I totally thought, from my memory, that Beelzemon Blast Mode activated when he tries... Later stuff happens that's particularly memorable, but I'm not going to mention it in case Ashley doesn't remember. But no, it happens way earlier in the episode, so that surprised me. I also just really like Calamon and Impmon working together. I think it's super sweet. As I kind of talked about early in the podcast, talking about Tamers, like, they start off kind of being like the two, like, devil angel on the shoulders kind of thing, dichotomy, duality. And they eventually, like, have very divergent arcs. They can go completely different directions. One of them is the source of digivolution to the world. The other one is, like, becomes a dark demon lord. And that now they've kind of gone their divergent ways and come back. And now they have, like, a shared purpose of helping Jerry with very different motivation. They're still kind of, like, very different characters. And, you know, Calamon is just trying to be directly supportive. Impmon just, like, I feel massive guilt and I want to help you, but I don't really know how I can help you. But they're united and it's really sweet and the imagery is cool. And yeah, they're cool. Yeah.
Ridiculous dialogue guy, where we each go around and pick our top three funniest, most ridiculous, and most touching lines from the episode. It's three because Andrew is not here.
we can do two. I don't know. I don't think there were that many good lines in these episodes. Do you guys have a lot, Ashley?
I only have three, but I also...
Yeah, let's do two.
Fine, we'll do two.
Ashley, Jeff, and then me.
Oh, God, what's my favorite? Oh, no.
Like, I have so many, I can't...
I will go with this one from episode 43. Pretty sure it's right in the beginning when all the, whatever, D-Reaper, the bird ones, stare at them. So Takato and everybody else all runs away. But then Giyomon stays and Takato's like,
Giyomon, what are you doing?
Staring contest.
Come on.
But I was winning.
I missed that.
Totally happened.
It totally happened. I remember
okay.
that.
I am taking this one. Not because it's good. It's terrible. I just want to shame it for how terrible it is. Because it's, oh my gosh. Okay. So it's, they're fighting the D-Reaper. I forget which form. The pendulum leg feet one. Anyway. And they're losing. It's one that can, like, echo the attacks back at it. They're losing. And Kaido's like,
is anything good ever going to happen to us?
And then Beelzemon flies in. He's like,
one good thing coming up.
And he's like, no. This is so stupid. Oh my God.
Oh, Beelzemon's the coolest.
Beelzemon, no, don't squander your potential. I love you, and this is what you've done. No, this is your entrance.
My turn. So this one's, I think it's from episode 43. I numbered the episodes 1, 2, and 3 because I couldn't remember what I was watching. Yamaki has just found the kids at the bakery. Zuccato recognizes Riley, and he's like,
wait a minute, I know you. You come here all the time to buy bread and those day-old bagels.
Hey, how's it going?
Those bagels were day old.
Yeah.
I was like, she's been feeding you dog treats, bro.
He's been doing bad by you.
Makes me happy.
I'm sure it does.
It does.
Okay. Now I have to go back to finding, which one do I want to say now?
Which one?
The left one.
Okay. I want to go with episode 42. Somewhere in Henry's house thing, he is talking to his sensei / grandfather / who knows. Man. Chinese man.
I think it's just sensei at this point. I don't know why I thought grandfather so much. Anyway.
Okay. So Henry says,
you were right, sensei. The devas didn't think they were evil because they believed in what they were doing.
Hmm. It's like the clouds.
Clouds?
What do we know about clouds?
They're cumulus?
Oh, boy.
Their conversations are great.
Oh, boy.
Full of gold.
So my quote has to be, this last one was like the Beelzebub's worst, his low point in ever in life. And I had to have this one just to honor him. So it's, they're like trying to, they're like, who are you? Wait, no. No, it's not the horror, because they know he's Beelzebub. He murdered their friends. No, they're just like,
wow.
They're like, oh, it's Imon. After the fight, they're like, oh, it's Imon. He's like,
hey, open the eyes. I'm not Imon anymore. I'm Beelzebub. You see, my outer finally matches my inner. I'm Blasmo Beautiful, and don't you forget it.
If you're just watching that, I feel like you wouldn't get necessarily that it actually is like he is Beelzebub Blasmo. Like it's a name of a thing.
Yeah, I did not know that was a thing.
Blasmo Beautiful. Like what? We almost named the podcast Blasma Beautiful.
Blasma Beautiful, baby. That's what he should have said.
I made up the baby, but Bullseye.
I mean, he definitely should have said it.
Bullseye, baby? Yeah.
All right. So this is from 42, probably. And Renamon says,
if it frightens a sovereign, it is not to be taken lightly.
It can't be taken lightly. It's the size of a house.
You get me, Terrarmon.
Also, it makes me wonder, like, does Terrarmon know the size of a house? Like, that is much more bigger than a house.
It's much bigger than a house, yes.
It's like several city blocks. But sure, Terrarmon.
Yes.
You do you.
Maybe that's the size of his house in the digital world, Jeff. You can't judge.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry.
Recommendation articulation.
So I have been doing a lot of prepping for Japanese studying. I'm trying to take JLPT in December, JLPT N3. So I've been looking through a lot of different resources. By the way, if you're not interested in studying Japanese, it's totally relevant to you. But if you are, cool. And yes, so one thing I found that has been a really cool resource is a YouTube channel called Nihongo no Mori, which means like forest of Japanese language. Anyway, and they have videos about Japanese grammar specifically for JLPT and more advanced. It starts with JLPT N3, so it's not really a good beginner resource, but if you're intermediate, it's good for that. And all these grammar videos are in Japanese fully, and there's no English spoken, and it's really cool. It's like an easy enough level of Japanese that if you are intermediate level, it's possible to understand it while struggling to. It's like just enough that you have to struggle to understand it, but it's possible, which I really like. It's really good. They're just good. Yes, highly recommended. And I assume they're also good for the higher levels. So I hope to keep up with them. That's my recommendation.
Okay. I'm going to recommend the rapper Lil Dicky.
No! No!
Yes! Yes!
No!
You're not allowed to talk back to me right now! You can't talk back to me! Shut up! He is apparently a Jewish rapper from Jeff and Maya's hometown, which is near Philadelphia, but not actually Philadelphia. He name drops it in a song. You can go find it, and then you'll know. But you should definitely listen to the song, Save That Money. You should watch the video. Unless you are offended by things, then you should not watch the video.
I hate it so much. I'm offended by his voice. I hate it.
No, it's so good. Jeff is just full of crap. Asher backs me up, right?
I do back you up.
His tone is so like, I'm gonna rap about things. This is what I'm gonna say. I'm just rapping about money. Saving money. I hate him.
Wow.
Jeff is wrong. But the song is amazing. It's so
the
good.
The video is amazing.
He is like a Jufro, right? Am I making that up? Am I forgetting?
I don't remember.
It's like a little bit of a Jufro.
You're wasting Ashley's time. All right.
I think I'm dead.
Okay, great. All right. So my recommendation, because I'm assuming everyone already has Pokemon Go and I don't need to recommend it, is...
Yeah, right.
Well, I'm actually curious because, like, it's going to be a month from now. Like, is Pokemon Go even going to be, like, talked about a month from now? Are we going to be, like, is this sighting going to end?
It's already, like, the highest grossing app or something.
People will have died from Pokemon Go by then. Yeah. People have been playing it in their cars. So anyway, I'm going to recommend the new Voltron series on Netflix. It is very, very good. The first episode is a little shaky because the pacing is weird. Normally, they're 30-minute episodes, and that one was like an hour. And they tried to cram a ton of information in at once, but the characters are wonderful. Pidge is the best. I recommend Pidge. That's my plug. Shiro is also very good. And like the whole team dynamics are really great. And it's a very snappily written show. The animation is gorgeous. It's by the Legend of Korra / Legend of Airbender people. That's not what it's called. it's very popular right now, so I'll be surprised if you haven't at least heard of it. But you have my word that it is excellent.
Okay. Do I need prior Voltron knowledge?
No, I have zero prior Voltron knowledge, and it's plenty accessible. They're cat robots in space.
I think this is what has prevented me from actually watching it thus far.
You do not need to know. All right. Okay. Yeah.
You can find the full show notes for this episode by going to podigest.com/311. You can leave us feedback in the comment section on the site, or you can just let us know your thoughts on Twitter, Tumblr, Facebook, Reddit, email, Withabo, SoundCloud, YouTube, Skywriting, Foreboding Prophecies, or color-coded smoke signals.
Although those won't work on Jeff.
Yeah, because Jeff apparently can't tell that Beelzebub's eyes change colors.
Just don't use red and green. Like I mean, you can use any other colors. Just like, and don't use like a dark blue and purple. But like, if you can use dark blue and you can use purple, just don't use both. And like, just choose red or green.
There are also lots of other things you can do for next week's feedback episode. Rate the episodes we covered on the show notes page. Vote on your favorite RDD clip on the show notes page so we can declare a winner of the draft. Leave a voicemail, 90 seconds or less, answering our question of the week.
Do you consider the Tamers a home?
You can either call 913-CALUMON if you're in the U.S., or send an audio recording to podigious@gmail.com. And don't forget, you can always leave a review for the podcast in iTunes to help us find new listeners, and we'll read and transgarble it on the show.
Podigious is made possible with the support from our awesome Patreon. Let's go. Amanda Angelman, Andre LeDucman, David Grauman, Eric Angemon, Jack Santa Aguman, Joe Keto, Justin Blaine Davis, Kai Lunamon, Kaiser Washi, Sam Kriwagamon, and Stevie Patamon. And now I'm just wondering if they all got into a giant Digimon fight, like who would win? Anyway.
If you want to support the show on Patreon, you can get some cool rewards, like access to our private Slack chat group for $1 a month, monthly stickers for $5 a month, and early episodes for $10 a month. Reaching our next goal will allow us to make podcast episodes about movies related to Digimon, so check out patreon.com/podigious to help us out.
You can find Podigious on Twitter, Tumblr, or Facebook to keep up with the Digimons and get funny images and GIFs related to the show. If you don't like how we pronounce GIF, you're wrong, then become a Patreon so you can vote on how we have to pronounce it. You can find me on Twitter at AshMcD00, Asher.
You can find me on Tumblr at AsherDashery.
Jeffery.
On Twitter at JeffLaneJeff.
And Andrew's at PhantomCellistF at Tumblr.
He's literally a phantom right now.
Oh!
Our Calumon artwork is by the awesome Mary Cagle, aka Cube Watermelon, on Tumblr and Twitter.
If you want us to talk about your Blast Mode beautiful feedback on the next feedback episode, get it in by 6 p.m. Pacific time on Wednesday, August 31st. Bullseye, baby.
Share the podcast with your friends who give you a really sweet heart t-shirt. But don't share the podcast with your friends who jump in with a totally unexplained and unwarranted Mega Digivolution.
Happens to me all the time. I hate those people.
Yeah. Schmucks.
Schmucks being schmucks.
And join us in 2 weeks as the world collapses under the existential dread of the D-Reaper.
Bye. Bye-bye.
And remember, never stop digivolving.
てて始まりそれが答えたのわらびざびが水も全速力で未来も今も駆け抜けろ
I mean, if we're going to pick one of these, then I guess when is Amon just Amon? But that's like, yeah, whatever. I'm good with it.
Mm-hmm. You've come to terms.
I've searched my soul.
Jeff disagrees. I heard it in his little...
Well, what does Jeff want?
Well, I don't know. I mean... We face the common problem of, like, I guess there's no harm in us using an episode title and also using it as the AKA for a thing. But the variant of when is Amon just Amon that I like better is when is a schmuck just a schmuck? It's about Rio.
We can do that. Yes, we can totally do that.
Sure. Fine.
So yeah, it would be the same as the AKA, but...
Oh, no, I hate when you do that, though.
Wait, you do?
Yeah. I like them to be different.
Let's see if I had alternatives for that one. I did not.
Did anyone else just, like, get really, really happy whenever Rio got smacked around? Like, I was so happy watching that episode. He didn't get to do anything.
They really hyped him up, and I'm like, he's not, like, what? He doesn't do anything.
It's great.
So, what was that? That episode was the was Amon just Amon?
We can name it Digimon Go because the Digimon are in the real world now.
Yes, let's do it.
Wait, this episode's gonna come out like a month from now, at least. And we're gonna be like,
who cares? People are still gonna be playing Pokemon Go in a month.
I'm still gonna be playing Pokemon Go in a month, and I'm going to be fit.
You're gonna have no fat anywhere.
I won't have an ounce of fat below my neck. Thank you, Davis.
Is that a thing he said?
That is a thing he said in the movie. I can quote large portions of the movie. What was I doing? Oh, I was looking for my Kakuna. Where is he? There he is. Somebody put a lure module in the Pokestop that is, like, literally on my apartment complex. So, like...
Damn you!
There's... That post office right across the street is a gym, and sometimes I can reach it from my window, and the...
I hate you!
There's a gazebo on my complex that I can also sometimes reach, depending on where I sit in the apartment and how accurate the GPS feels like being.
I do not like you.
I told you guys start recording, and I didn't do it myself. So.
Wow.
Fool.
Well, okay. I started two of them long ago, and I started the third now. I mean, having the three, there was at least one recording where I forgot to do two of them, so it's a good thing I have three.
Yeah, I guess. It's a little silly, but...
A little excessive.
A little bit.
What do I want to say?
We've got to do some singing.
Thank you, yep. Ashley. Let's go.
Digits.
We're back in the real world for some more Digimon Go. Welcome to Podigis, episode 311. When is a schmuck just a schmuck? Well, some Jews have jobs, Ash.
Oh. I have jobs. I got my first paycheck for a Shabbat service last night.
Wait, people get paid for that?
Yeah. For leading it, yes.
Oh my god, did you get paid like $20?
No, anyway. I got paid $100, man.
Wait, you led it? That means you're like the dude in the front.
Well, it was a small service. It was at a retirement home.
Astra's like, there were like two people.
No, there were like 10 people there. But it was in a room. We were all seated at a dinner table. It was not, I was not on the bima, you know, preaching to a 400 family congregation. Mm-hmm. But that is a thing I could do. It's a thing you could do too, Jeffrey, because you have been bar mitzvahed.
Oh.
Jeffrey, why aren't you making that extra money on the side?
The D-Reaper takes a steak. Blah, blah,
blah. Takes a steak.
Yum, yum, yum.
The D-Reaper raises the stakes. Yeah, yeah. I'm trying to be like enunciating. The D-Reaper raises the stakes. Oh, I wasn't?
No. In episode 43, Beelzebub's big day. Nope. Day.
What?
I don't know.
How did you?
Jerry gets an angel growth spurt and an unwanted guest reappears. Reappears. Ha ha.
What?
Oh.
Oh. Oh my god, actually.
No, we're leaving it like that.
No. Come on. We can put in the outtakes, but then the main thing, it should be coherent.
Jerry gets an angel growth spurt and an unwanted guest reappears.
Yeah, so episodes, Digimon Tamers, Real World, D-Reaper, Buzzword, growth hacking, social engineering, stuff. Okay, yes. So
Jeff, are you okay?
Do you need help?
It just reminds me that I tweeted saying yesterday that one of my coworkers replied to with like, "Are you on drugs?"
Wait, what was it?
It's I don't know. It's understandable without context. Well, yeah, Ash, have you seen JoJo's at
no.
all?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Do you know the like it's me Dio meme?
Yeah.
So okay. So and you know that the new series is Diamond is Unbreakable?
Yes.
Have you watched it at all?
I haven't watched this week's.
Oh, okay, but you see, okay, so you know that like
yeah. And I also read all the manga through number 6. I read through Jolin. I don't care about this alternate universe crap.
Wait, it goes into an alternate universe?
Yeah, it goes to an alternate universe. Mm.
Anyway, so Ashley, the main character of Diamond is Unbreakable, the latest JoJo part, is someone who can, I guess, repair things. He can beat things up and then repair it, like restore it to a previous state. And that's one part you need to know. Another part is that the main villain of like several parts of JoJo's is a like vampire named Dio. And apparently there's like a scene early on where like this like woman thinks that her first kiss is kissing one of the JoJo people, but instead Dio is like, haha, it was me in disguise. It was me, Dio, all along. So that became a meme, people saying it was me, Dio. Okay, so that's the context you need for the joke. I said, holy crap, Diamond is Unbreakable, then arrow, D-I-U, then an arrow. U is like a broken O, then an arrow. Diamond, crazy Diamond restores the U to an O. It was me, Dio. And that's what my coworker replied to. Are you on drugs?
Wee.
Yeah.
Aster doesn't approve.
Hang on a sec.
No, are you catching a Pokemon? What are you doing?
Oh, God, I hope
what?
Not.
What?
Were you catching a Pokemon?
I said, no, are you catching a Pokemon? What are you doing?
I was taking off my shirt because it's really hot, and I turn off my air conditioning for you people.
They don't know they're actually the ones out there fighting. They think they're just, like, accompanying them, which is still bad, but, like...
Oh. Whoa. Oh, yeah. Okay, general discussion over.
Okay.
What is that?
What is that? Why?
All right, what's next?
You thought it was a Pokemon, didn't you?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so I have a lengthy roundabout journey of a topic.
Jeffrey, is there any other type of topic with you? I
mean... So where my head is at the end of this discussion of home... And having written home like 50 million times in my notes and in the middle of like learning Japanese, about to go to Japanese class after this, is just like, what are words? What is like, and it's like home is.
Jeffrey, I think you wrote too many words that about this and then you were just wrong. Now you just feel bad.
No. Like I had this thought while writing the words. It's just like home, like all this talk about like what home is, what's concept, but like home is just like an arbitrary English word, you know, like it's
oh,
just
God.
Like.
All well, right, like, Jeffrey, we're not going here.
With English major on us, Ashley.
Oh, my God.
I shouldn't be so reductive, because what we're talking about is the concept. And that's a lower level than the language word. But, like, to some level, we're talking about, like, is this a home or not? It's like, well, I mean, so what? Like, in another language, like, you would have a different word that encompasses more meanings. And, of course, it's that. Anyway.
Okay. We went, like, 10 minutes over time.
Like I said, we're not going there.
Okay. Side note, Ashley and I are going to Maine.
The Dark Ocean?
No, well, kind of. we're going to Maine next week, and one of the places we're stopping on the way is Portsmouth, which I was confused. And I was like, that's the place where they go to in, that's like the name of the fake town by the Dark Ocean that Kari walks by. I was confused. That's Innsmouth. Innsmouth is the like fictional Lovecraft town. But for a second, I was really excited. I was like, oh yeah, we're going to the Dark Ocean, but no. Anyway.
Wow.
I'm trying to share video or share screen. Do you guys see it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you see Rika's face?
Yes.
Her beautiful, beautiful face. Was that weird?
It's a little weird. She's 10.
I agree.
Jeff, did you notice that Beelzemon's eye color changed?
No. From what to what?
Red to green. That's why I asked.
Wait, like, what?
It changed from red to green. He's not evil anymore.
Yeah, when the gun turns into a real gun, it shows that his eye color is no longer red and
I don't
evil.
Believe you.
No, it's true.
It totally happened.
You know, when I was in fifth grade, I think it was, I was like heavily involved in Digimon Forum and stuff, and I was like addicted to it. Like, cost me friends in real life, whatever. But anyway, I had this weird thought from time to time that like Digimon wasn't real. That like it was something that like people put on the internet to like trick me into like, and it didn't make any sense because it's like, well, but it exists. Like, if they made it just to target me, like it still exists. Anyway, that's what you're doing. Like, you're making up this false reality about Digimon to trick me. The eye color.
No. Oh, okay, my turn.
Yeah, like, but would you call like fan art? What would you call like fan art of like Ken and Daisuke hugging?
I would call it fan art.
Yeah.
I am long past the point where I like label things by the type of. No, it's just like, because yaoi means porn, and like.
Oh, it does?
It implies porn. I don't know what it actually means, literally.
Oh, right. Oh, I did not mean.
Oh, Jeffrey, what have you done?
I tried to search Wikipedia for yaoi because I thought it would give me like the meaning. Or I either meant to search Wikipedia or like Jisho, like the Japanese dictionary, which would either be like in my like browser J for Jisho or W for Wikipedia. And because I was confused with the two of them, I typed Y instead, which is YouTube. So I searched YouTube for yaoi and I don't think.
Good job.
I don't know if anything explicit would have actually come up, but I was just like, oh god, no, I don't want videos of this. According to gshow.org, it's like just manga on the theme of male homosexual love.
Whatever.
But I don't know.
Maybe the definition has changed over the years. It's quite possible.
But I assume there was like a Japanese word it, meant before it had that meaning.
Sam Kriwagamon and Stevie Patamon. And now I'm just wondering if they all got into a giant Digimon fight, like who would win? Anyway.
Hold on. Here's how you need to actually. Do I have the volume up? So, okay, here's how you need to read the names. Come on, wrap it out, Ashley.
And I'm, okay. Amanda Anjumon. Andre LeDucmon.
We abort, this is terrible, abort.
David Grandma. Eric Angemon.
Oh my god. They're doing the voice actually. He's like, Eric Angemon. Jackson.
You know, that's not his voice, right? This is what I've been hearing. You don't know. No, that's some featured person's voice. Yeah.
No. But now I feel bad about it. I only want to make fun of him.
Well, that's what. You are offensive. You're wrong. I'm pretty sure that's like. There are multiple people featured in the track, and I'm pretty sure that's not him.
Oh, I was like, it's not problematic if I'm making fun of a white Jewish boy.
Yep, but you're not. I'm pretty, like, pretty sure it's...
You're problematic, Jeff.
No! Now I just fade away rich and homie just crumble Kwan to dust.
I don't know. I'm pretty sure it's not him on the chorus.
But, like, I think it is him, and it's just him trying to, get this, like, I'm so cool rapper voice.
I mean, that's possible too. Quite honestly, anytime I listen to this song, I'm like, I'm not really like, there are distinct points where you're like, okay, that's not him. points where I'm like, I'm not sure.
You finished actually reading the names for real, right?
I did.
Okay.
Joe Keto.
No. Okay. Reaching our next goal will allow us to make podcast episodes about movies related to Digimon. So check out patreon.com/podigis to help us out.
Also, we mean Summer Wars, and in our Slack, all we're doing is talking about Pokemon Go.
But this,
I just caught a Tauros, guys.
As of the time of recording this, this is like a couple of days after Pokemon Go came out. This will probably be come out. This episode will come out like a month or nine. And be like, Pokemon Go, what is that about? Also, Ash, your comment about like your comment about Pokemon Go killing people. There was a really good Medium article about how black dudes playing Pokemon Go have a very realistic risk of, you know, like circling a location, being flagged by people as very suspicious, and they can't really play it and without putting their lives in danger. So
you can find me on Twitter at I was like, is at the right thing? Yes.
Digivolve your differences.
Digivolve all your differences.
Okay, bye.